Wales has dropped to a new record low. So, have you postponed parenthood? But first, my colleague Jeremy Hunt says children and young people are being overdiagnosed with mental health conditions, losing sight of the reality that child development is, in the words of the report, messy and uneven. So have we ended up limiting what it means to be normal in a desire to be tolerant, and what needs to change?
On your radio, on the LBC app, and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 10 o'clock, three children are among at least 14 people killed in a huge Russian attack on Kyiv overnight. Officials in Ukraine say dozens more civilians are injured after apartment blocks were hit by hundreds of drones and missiles. It's the largest such attack since Vladimir Putin's talks with Donald Trump in Alaska. Elena Halushka, co-founder of the International Center for Ukrainian Victory, spent the night in shelter.
On one hand, they are pretending that they are engaging in the peace talks. You know, that Russians are talking to President Trump. We are listening and hearing from President Trump for actually the last half a year, that two more weeks and then there might be sanctions. But simultaneously, Russians are doing nothing except killing Ukrainians.
Judges are due to hear the latest stage of a row over the use of a hotel in Essex to house asylum seekers. The Home Office and the owner of the site in Epping are seeking to overturn a High Court injunction granted last week. LBC's Shivani Sharma has more from the Court of Appeal.
The council's lawyer managed to successfully get a temporary interim injunction last week by arguing that the Bell Hotel owners didn't have the right planning permission to house asylum seekers. But the owner and the Home Office will be looking to overturn this today. And the pressure on government is significant, with the deadline for it to remove asylum seekers from that hotel just over 2 weeks away.
Sir Jeremy Hunt has backed calls to radically reform special educational needs in England's schools. The former health secretary's warned of an overdiagnosis of mental health conditions. He's used the foreword of a policy exchange report to warn society has lost sight of the realities of child development. Landlords could face a tax hike in Rachel Reeves' budget this autumn. Treasury officials are reportedly looking at levying national insurance on rental income to raise about £2 billion. Christian May is editor-in-chief at City AM.
A lot of people have said will just lead to people selling up and getting out of the market, to which some people have said, fine, good, put those properties back on the market. But it just goes to show, I think, the extent to which this government is getting increasingly desperate in its search for money.
The Treasury says it's committed to keeping taxes for working people as low as possible. The director of the US Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has been sacked. Susan Menares's departure from the CDC follows growing tensions over vaccine policies and public health directives. The White House says she wasn't aligned with the president's agenda of making America healthy again. In the city, the FTSE 100 a short time ago was at 92.26, that is down 29. The pound buys $1.35 and a euro 16. LBC weather, sunshine and scattered showers for many places. The rain will be heavy and quite thundery at times, with the possibility of some hail. A high of 23 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Thomas Watt.
Get the new Google Pixel 10 Pro on EE and save a huge £544. And talk to Gemini about anything you see.
Like reorganizing my living room.
Exactly.
Or helping us decide which top to wear with me jeans.
Yep, that too.
What about my old phone?
Trade in and save even more. All on the UK's best network. No wonder tech lovers are choosing EE.
Introductory offer ends 15th of September. Trading discount dependent on device. Savings across contract. Eligibility, credit check and terms apply. Credit by EE Limited. Verify best network at ee.co.uk/claims.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with James Cleverly.
Good morning. You're listening to me, James Cleverly, standing in for James O'Brien on LBC until 1 o'clock today.
Later on this morning, I am going to be talking about a couple of issues which are in the news, including the falling birth rate, people not having as many children as they used to. And I'm also going to be talking about the German cabinet's move to increase the number of people volunteering for the German armed forces. And I want to find out whether that's something that you'd be willing to do here in Britain, volunteer to fight for the country. But the first thing that I want to talk about this morning is a report that's come out from a think tank, which has been forwarded by my good friend and colleague, Jeremy Hunt. And the report basically says that we are over-diagnosing young people with regard to their mental health. And Jeremy's argument is that a young person's development is messy, it's complicated, it's difficult, and it always has been. But what we're doing is we are medicalizing the normality of childhood. We're giving a diagnosis that's leading to an EHCP, which for many of you, you will know that is the certificate which basically enables greater support at school for young people. And this is all well-intentioned and it's done for the right reasons, but ultimately it is creating a real limit on just natural and normal childhood. And it is creating an unsustainable pressure on the public purse. And I've been thinking a lot about this. I've got two boys. They grew up in the way that I would expect boys to be, rough and tumble. They weren't always the most focused, sometimes easily distracted. They needed to burn off energy. And for me, that was the normal part of childhood. But I could easily have seen how, looked at it from a different angle. My kids could have been seen as not being as attentive as they needed to be at school. But would it have been right to have that as a diagnosis? Would that have helped them? Would it have helped the school? Would it have helped me as a parent? Or would it have painted them into a corner, defined them in a certain way, and perhaps influenced their future behaviour? I want to find out what you think about this issue, whether we are over-diagnosing children, because I think we are. And I think that it is, as I say, driven by good intentions, but ultimately what it's doing is really narrowing the definition of a normal childhood. And in doing so, we are making more young people, more children, feel as if they are not normal, as if they are something different. And I think that in itself can have perhaps a stigmatizing effect. Now, I'm not suggesting that no children need help. Of course, I'm not saying that at all. What I'm saying is the kids that really need help should get help, but the children, the young people who should be able to just, you know, graze their knees, run about, burn off energy, should be allowed to do so in the way that I think we have done for most of human history. And I'm not the only person that thinks that. On Nick's show earlier on this morning, Jane Harris, who's from a disabled children's charity, and she's an expert in speech and language. She said to Nick that she disagrees with some of the report's findings about overdiagnosis, but she did agree that there has been a narrowing of what is considered normal childhood behaviour. Let's listen to what she told Nick earlier this morning.
An EHCP usually is requested by a school because they, or a nursery, because they know that a child is struggling and they know they don't have the expertise and resources to help that child. But the key point is that if schools were run in a different way, some of those children might not need an EHCP, right? If we had schools that actually worked in a way that supported these children, one of the things that's happened in our schools over the last 10, 15 years is they've become more and more rigid. So there's kind of rules in schools now, like you can't, you know, use a ball in the playground. There's rules in schools like, you know, children all the time have to keep their eyes on the teachers. Well, an autistic child couldn't do that. 50 years ago, a child like that might have coped in school and might never, some of those children, not all of them, some of them would absolutely have always needed an EHCB, but some of them would have coped. But it's that we've changed the culture of schools to a point that more and more children need something different from what our schools are giving them.
So do these children need more opportunities to burn off energy? Do we need to recognise that not all children learn in the same way? I think we've always known this, but do we need to formally recognise it within school structures? Have we created an environment where children are being so constrained, so boxed in, so tightly defined that they can't be their natural and normal selves? And have we created a whole load of unintended consequences through our desire to better understand children and better to support them through their education? I want to hear from you. I want to hear about your experience. I want to hear about whether you think that actually a little bit more flexibility, a little bit more understanding that, you know, not all kids are the same, would actually be a better response to this than this overly formalised, overly bureaucratic, and frankly, financially unsustainable system that I think has developed over quite a number of years, certainly a decade plus. But also, what is your experience of trying to navigate the education system or life in general if you have a child that does need additional support? Because the byproduct of narrowing this definition of normal childhood behaviour and the byproduct of having a framework of additional support that needs to, you know, go through various assessments and that kind of stuff is that the waiting list for support is absolutely huge. I've lost track of the number of people in my constituency who write to me frustrated that they're having to wait a very, very, very long time for the help that they think that they need. So could we avoid having such a constrained environment if we were just a little bit more flexible? I think we've got time to go to Martin in Coventry quickly before the news. Martin, what are your thoughts on this?
I was just saying to your colleague before I came on, I feel that the EHCP is, in terms of education, it's a beneficial thing for children. From my perspective, we didn't need a diagnosis for our child before we got the EHCP. We had a very proactive nursery and early years team who identified learning needs and were able to get that assessment. And we found that in terms of providing the funding for one-to-one education, it was more beneficial for our child.
So how easy was it for you to get this? Because for people who get it, I'm guessing that's a real benefit, and I totally understand that. But do you think that was the only way of getting support for your kid? Do you think there could have been a better way? Do you think there could have been perhaps a less bureaucratic, more organic way to get the kind of help and support that that your child needed?
So in terms of easiness of getting it, it wasn't easy, but we weren't in a rush at that time. So as I said, we had a proactive nursery. Our child was just towards the age of three when we identified needs and we were able to put in for the EHCP. It is a long process, but that's mostly down to the local authorities being overrun, understaffed. In terms of not having a diagnosis, before the EHCP, that wasn't a problem until he became in education and we needed that diagnosis to get other support from healthcare professionals.
I don't want to go into too much detail about your personal circumstances, but I'm genuinely interested in the point that Jane was making, which is that if schools were better at understanding the diversity of the children that are in their classes, that some are, you know, much better at concentrating than others, some need more regular breaks than others, etc., etc. And she was saying we used to be better at that. Do you think that would have been enough for your child, or do you genuinely believe this was the only way forward for you?
I think in order for the school to get that funding, the EHCP has been beneficial. I think we are fortunate because the school that our child is a small school. It has very small classes. I mean, reception, there's less than 20. And the same with year one, there's less than 20 children in each class. So I think having the support has enabled them to get a one-to-one assistant for part of the day, which has made the difference because our child does not sit down and will not just sit and work like others may. So having that other person takes the pressure off that single teacher and allows them to focus on the whole class while someone else supports our child.
And so you think that the teacher, perhaps, the point I'm making is that there are some children that maybe don't strictly need an EHCP. I totally understand that their parents, like you did, want to get something that they believe not only helps their own child, but helps the school and therefore by extension helps other children in the class. So you're, if I'm summing it up right, you're saying that giving support to your child enables the teacher to give more support to the rest of the kids in the class. So would that be a fair assessment of how you're seeing things?
I think that's quite a narrow view because we're looking at everybody as a whole. So my child's getting support and everyone else is getting support. So it's not taking one away from the other. It's providing everybody with a similar amount of support to meet their needs. And I think that's the most important thing because if you are in a class of 30 and you've got one teacher and one support assistant, and I think somebody else mentioned about some statistics, there's 10 children with EHCPs or SEN needs within their class out of 30, that would be quite difficult. So I think having that support for the individual is beneficial to everybody and the individual involved.
Martin, thank you very much for your call. And if you've got something to say on this issue, you can call me on 0345 6060973, WhatsApp on the same number. You're listening to me, James Cleverley, standing in for James O'Brien, and the time now is 10:16.
LBC.
The Harwoods Upgrade event starts on the 4th of September. Upgrade your car with our bespoke offers to a new 75 registration at Harwoods Audi Southampton and Portsmouth, or a premium used model at Harwoods Assured Chichester. Find out more at harwoods.co.uk. But don't delay. The event ends Sunday the 7th. Harwoods, family owned since 1931.
Chase is the digital bank that could boost your savings.
Ooh, tell me more.
When you join Chase, you could earn 4.75% AER variable. That includes a 2.25% AER fixed boost for 12 months on top of our standard saver rate.
Oh, yeah, nice.
Yep, our savings boost could help you reach your goals, like a rainy day fund for peace of mind. Get our best easy access saver offer today. Search Chase Boosted Saver. Offer may be withdrawn at any time. 18 plus UK residents available to new current account customers for your first 31 days. Eligibility applies. 4.65% gross. Terms apply.
Buying a home on a holiday park was the retreat you always wanted. But then came unexpected site fee increases. And that was before the dramatic loss in value. If you bought a home on a holiday park in the UK, you may have been missold. Holidayparkadvicecentre.co.uk could help you receive thousands in compensation. Text ADVICE to 78900. That's ADVICE to 78900.
James Cleverley on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
You're listening to me, James Cleverley, on LBC, standing in for James O'Brien. And we're talking about a report on the apparent overdiagnosis of children with mental health and special needs. And the question I'm asking is, have we ended up so limiting how we define childhood, just the normal diversity of childhood, that we're making it difficult for the children, for the schools, and for ourselves? I've got Gabby in Bushy. Gabby, what would you like to say?
Hi, James. I think this narrative that the parents and the children are being overdiagnosed is a real misrepresentation of what's happening at the moment. I don't doubt that there is probably been a spike in diagnosis and that will put pressure on the public purse, but the reason why there is pressure on the public purse is because the send provision, the argument is always that send provision costs too much money and that it's a drain on resource or it's a drain on the public purse. But since 2014, nearly half, £500 million has been spent on local authorities taking parents to tribunal. I think people think getting an EHCP is this magic gateway into extra support. And for some people, it definitely is. And it's well deserved for those who need it.
But, so, Gary, can I just pull you up on one thing?
Yeah.
And I want to let you finish your point, but I also want you to think about whether it's not just a financial thing, whether it's also about how we treat the children and young people themselves. Because one of the things that worries me is that in, as I say, a well-intentioned, and I do genuinely believe it's a well-intentioned desire to create a supportive framework for the child, we are telling them that they are, for want of a better word, not normal, and that they are somehow different. And actually, I think one of the points that Jeremy's putting across in the report is that, you know, childhood, adolescence, it is messy and it is tricky and it is difficult. So not just about the money. Now, there are, of course, pressures on the public purse. That is a fair point. But also, what do you think about the fact that actually we are inadvertently painting children and young people into a bit of a corner when actually there has always been this range of personality types, behaviours, etc., etc.?
I think it's a bit of a red herring. It completely depends on the child or the young person's need. I agree that children need to be challenged, built resilience, need to be able to express themselves, and that should always be encouraged, especially in a school setting. And I do think that school settings have, you know, I haven't been at school for a long time myself, but they've obviously changed in the sense that there isn't as much support or extra staff or the ability for children to regulate themselves. And that might just be through more exercise and things like that. But if for a child to be able to regulate their emotions through that form of expression, to me would indicate that the child is able to cope in a mainstream school, because there are going to be children who aren't in that environment who need a high, high level of intervention to be able to learn and thrive. And I think, like I said, this idea that we are over-diagnosing or kind of labelling children, in essence, a lot of the time, that's not indicative of their pathway, because so many children, like the situation I'm going through myself, have a specific diagnosis, have overwhelming evidence supported by their, you know, nursery practitioners, doctors, proper evidence, and they're still not getting the access to the education they need. My child is 4, she's due to start school in September. We still do not have a school place, because we are fighting a legal battle. And I know your point is basically outlining the fact that a lot of children might be being led down a pathway that they might actually not need to go to. But actually what I think is also happening here is that mainstream schools have been cut so viscerally that a lot of the emotional and behavioural issues are being more exposed. And that's why it's causing this issue. And the system is completely broken. And any child who has a need, whether it's emotional, from a speech and language point of view, cognitive, it doesn't matter what it is, deserves to learn in an environment that is right for them. We should be encouraging children from all walks of life and backgrounds, no matter what their need is, to learn and thrive. And we should not be categorizing children and just putting them in these sort of one-size-fits-all environments like mainstream schools tend to be, because the world has changed and needs have changed. And why can't we meet those needs and give children the opportunity to thrive?
Gabby, I think you make a really, really good point. And I don't want to put words in his mouth, but I think the point that Jeremy is trying to get across, and one of the things that I think, is that a mainstream school shouldn't necessarily be a one-size-fits-all. Gabby, thank you for your call. Can I now go to Suzanne Westcliff-on-Sea in the fantastic county of Essex?
Yeah, it's so hot here. It's lovely. The sea is glistening. The sand is white. Anyway, I run children's cooking lessons. I've been doing it from home for 20 years, and I've had
children I've had, imagine the amount of kids I've had over 20 years coming to cook. Lately, the last, I'd say, 3 or 4 years, maybe since after COVID, really, I've had a lot of parents say, oh, by the way, my son, my daughter is autistic. Is that okay? I take all kids. And in the past, I've had extreme autism. I've had children with extreme dyspraxia, autism, etc., who, you know, the type of child will sort of go away for a minute and sort of like hide under the table and that sort of thing, or run down, you know, try and escape. But lately, the last few years, I've been saying, so only a few weeks ago, a child came to me. The mum said, oh, he's got autism. There was no signs. He was no signs. Not that I'm saying there should be a sign, but, you know, already, you know, she's telling him, he's at the door with her, oh, he's autistic, and he's looking at her, yeah, I'm autistic. You know, the amount of kids I've had, the comparison, so when you say the word apparent, you know, these children, they're naughty, just maybe they want to be a bit naughty, they're exploring life as a child, but this boy, once he got into his cooking, wow, he's fantastic, he's a real foodie, he enjoyed it, he was so good, did what he was told, he focused well. Okay, that was only an hour, 2 hours. Okay, I don't know what he's like, you know, what obviously living with this child is like as a child. But the label, and also, you know, you get TikToks. Oh, this is ADHD. I've got ADHD. It's like almost cool now to have ADHD. And it's very...
Suzanne, one of the things that I have seen and really plays on my thinking is that particularly when it comes to a diagnosis, perhaps even that word, it is something that we do through the medical process. It is something that identifies a problem, and then ultimately we seek to address that problem. And I worry that applying even implicitly the idea that this child has a problem, saying that to the child early on in their life, I think can perhaps narrow their future options, creates a mindset within the child that somehow they're going to be held back, rather than, and I, reading between the lines, I think this is what you're seeing with your cookery classes, is that if you can find something that really enthuses that young person, that really plays to their strengths rather than exposes the kind of weaknesses that we all have. We all have strengths and weaknesses, that actually you can find a better way of navigating what is always going to be a tricky and difficult path. Suzanne, thank you very much for your call. Let's quickly go to Wendy in Bristol. What would you like to say, Wendy?
Hi, I'm just listening to you. I'm in London at the moment, actually, and I've taught in special education for over 20 years. I've run pupil referral units for children who've been permanently excluded from school, and I've worked in specialist settings, mainly with children with mental health difficulties, which I think is one of the focuses of this report.
Yeah.
And one of the things that we know is that a main driver for mental health difficulties and what schools might call behavioural difficulties is a sense of shame and a sense of fear. And my feeling is that when we ask four-year-olds, and particularly four-year-old little boys, to sit on the carpet and learn phonics and learn to read when they're not ready for it, they don't behave, they get labelled as difficult, it creates a sense of shame and failure in the child and putting too much pressure on them. That's where we're going wrong right at the beginning, and what we should be looking at is the European models of allowing children to play for longer, to learn to read at a later age when they then pick it up really fast. And I think we just need to look at that whole kind of early years and Key Stage 1 curriculum and look at how we might change that.
So do you think, and I'm really keen not to put words in your mouth, but do you think that actually recognising, particularly in early years, that the difference between children is so significant that actually some children need to run around, burn off more energy, some children want to sit quietly on the carpet with a nice picture book or whatever, and are you suggesting that we're not as good at responding to that difference of personality types and behavior as we should be?
I think the curriculum isn't designed properly at that stage, and it puts too much emphasis on learning. And there are, don't get me wrong, there are children who do have additional needs, and they do need an EHCP, and they do need to be supported either in a mainstream school or in a specialist provision. But there are also children where I think they end up with this label of having difficult behaviour because they weren't ready for formal education. And we put an emphasis on doing that very early in this country. And perhaps if we waited a little bit, all children would benefit from it, even the ones that are ready to sit and learn, you know, and sit down. They don't have those problems abroad. You look at the Dutch study that's just been done saying that Dutch children are the happiest because they don't have that pressure put on them. This goes back to, you know, league tables from years ago and putting all that pressure on parents, schools and children to perform. And this whole thing that leads to a sense of shame in children. So often, you know, difficult behaviour in school is linked to a child having a real deep sense of shame and failing in the school system.
Well, I think that's... It's sad when I hear comments like that, because as a parent, I suppose even if I wasn't a parent, we would all want to see a situation where children are as happy and as socialised and as ready to learn as possible. And I instinctively agree with your concerns that, as I say, in a desire to help, we have actually created a situation that can be counterproductive. And I think this is the point that Jeremy has made. So, Wendy, thank you very much for your call. You're listening to me, James Cleverly. Now, more of your calls on this subject on the way. So if you want to get involved in the conversation, you can call me on 0345 60 60973. You can WhatsApp me on the same number. We're now going to the news headlines at 10:30 with Thomas Watts.
14 people are now known to have been killed in a Russian bombardment of Ukraine's capital. Officials in Kiev say Moscow fired almost 600 drones and more than 30 ballistic and cruise missiles overnight. An attempt to overturn a ban on housing asylum seekers in a hotel in Epping is being heard at the Court of Appeal. The Home Office and the hotel's owner are trying to challenge a High Court injunction. A government minister has refused to be drawn on reports the Treasury is considering a tax hike on landlords. Officials are reportedly looking at requiring national insurance contributions to be paid on rental income. LBC weather, sunshine and scattered showers for many. The rain heavy and thundery at times, a high of 23 degrees.
The all-new LBC app. News your way. Download it for free from the App Store. This is LBC.
The Harwoods Upgrade event starts on the 4th of September. Upgrade your car with our bespoke offers to a new 75 registration at Harwoods Audi Southampton and Portsmouth, or a premium used model at Harwoods Assured Chichester. Find out more at harwoods.co.uk. But don't delay. The event ends Sunday the 7th. Harwoods, family owned since 1931.
Sometimes in life, it can feel like you're disappearing into the crowd. We all do it. Dip below the radar. There's nothing wrong with that. But sometimes you want to find something more.
With the RAF reserves, you can break away from the crowd and find yourself with a new one, like these refugees we're delivering aid to.
And be back feeling a little different on a Monday morning.
RAF Reserves Cranwell are now recruiting for spare time roles. Search RAF Reserves. Find something more. Find your force.
The seagull says, your IKEA food favourites are now available in Brighton. Meatballs, plant balls, fish and chips. All delicious. Especially the chips. Yum. IKEA Brighton, open 14th of August. IKEA, the wonderful everyday.
Check out PayPal, 3% cash back on my day out to the beach.
I got cash back on a train ticket to Brighton.
Ow, ow!
And I used PayPal to buy this speaker.
Get ready for some Brighton rock.
Last month, I got cash back on this sweet portable barbecue.
How do you want your burger? Medium? Rare? Wet?
your trusted way to pay. Now with 3% cash back all summer. Sign up in the app. Check out PayPal. Promo ends 30th of September. Activate offer in the app and select a category each month. Max £15 per month. T's and C's apply.
This is LBC with James Cleverly. Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
You're listening to me, James Cleverly, on LBC, and I'll be going back to more calls on the subject of whether or not we over-diagnose children and young people with regard to their mental health. Please get in touch. You don't have to be from Essex, although it seems to help. Martin in Clacton-on-Sea, what have you got to say on this?
Hi, James. I just wanted to look at the money being wasted on this. I mean, we're talking about saving money, but in Essex, which is obviously where your constituency is, where I live, 99% of the appeals against EHCP rejections by Essex County Council, which is Tory-led, fail. And so they spend millions in lawyer fees, legal fees, in which to defend these cases. I actually only got diagnosed with ADHD last year at the age of 31. I obviously would have had this my whole life, and for a number of years throughout my childhood, young adult life, and the rest of my life, really, have felt inadequate and unable to achieve what I had always wanted to try and achieve, not for want of trying. And actually, understanding the way in which my brain worked made me feel a whole lot better. So I had diagnoses of anxiety, depression, etc., because I was feeling like I was not normal, like I couldn't achieve. And actually, I disagree that earlier on you said about telling kids that they weren't normal because of the diagnoses at an earlier age. I actually disagree. I think I would have felt more understanding of the way in which my brain works. Not normal, just different. And would have been able to achieve better by knowing how my brain works. Because since my diagnosis, I now know the way in which my brain works and be able to adapt and make myself achieve the things that I put my mind to rather than just banging my head against a brick wall.
So, Martin, I think you make a really interesting point, and I'm not sure we are disagreeing quite as much as perhaps you think. So you're saying you had a diagnosis, but it was depression and anxiety. Once you had the ADHD diagnosis, which you had in your 30s, obviously that then doesn't come with an EHCP or educational support, but it was about helping you understand yourself better and understand how best to navigate the world, I think is what you were saying. So had you been given the tools and perhaps the self-confidence to navigate the world, would it have necessarily needed that diagnosis, that definition, in order to unlock what sounds like helping you get to a good place where you are now?
I think that if I was a child and I understood the way in which my brain worked, which is not abnormal, just different, then I would have potentially been able to achieve the things that I wished I had when I was younger. I mean, if you look at a number of things, relationships, achieving through career, etc., there's things that I look back on and see that the way in which I was doing things was just a way in which my brain couldn't comprehend rather than something I couldn't do. And now I'm achieving by doing things in a different way. So yes, I feel that I maybe had 15 years of my life, and I mean only including my kind of teenage years, because that's kind of when we talk about career, that I could have done different, done better, purely by knowing that my brain worked in the way it does, rather than trying to assume myself as just being a failure at being normal, if you get what I mean.
I do, And again, my concern about this is that in a desire to understand, we lose track of the natural diversity of people, and that when people better understand themselves, their strengths, their weaknesses, their opportunities and limitations, it helps them navigate the world more effectively. Martin, thank you very much for your call. I'm going to go to Dean now in Durham. Dean, what are your thoughts?
Hi, James. Thanks. So, yeah, like your previous caller, I don't have any children of my own, but I am autistic. I have a late life diagnosis, and I just kind of want to talk about how things changed for me when I got my diagnosis. So, I kind of look back at my life and think, as a child growing up, I was masking. I was pretending to be normal when I wasn't normal in the traditional sense of the word. So I was imitating the people around me, but that wasn't my natural state. And that left me very withdrawn outside of these social situations. I'd do my own thing. I'd be very introverted. And I would struggle socially because it would feel very much like I am playing a game with everybody else, but everybody else had the rule book and I didn't. And everything that they were learning intuitively and doing naturally, I had to put a lot of effort and conscious thought into doing the same thing.
Dean, on that point,
yeah.
If there were an opportunity to navigate your way through school and childhood in a way that better suited you, would that have been better than necessarily having a diagnosis? And this is, I think, the point I'm really seeking to explore. If we were better at saying that Dean, you know, is not comfortable doing this, but he loves doing that, is not good at this, but he's great at that, and we don't necessarily want to put a label on it or a diagnosis on it, but actually what we're going to do is find opportunities for Dean, the younger version of you, to do the things in the way that works better for you. If that had happened, do you think you would have still desired or needed that formal definition or diagnosis?
I think I would, because where that clashes is where then you sort of interact with neurotypical environments and neurotypical worlds. So it's fine to create this world that's ideal for me while I'm growing up and everything else like that, but there will come a time where that no longer exists, where I have to interact with the neurotypical world. And then for me, I imagine that clash would be more jarring because people won't be as accommodating, or the world will not be able to do these things I need it to do, and I won't have an idea why. Whereas now, with a diagnosis, what I can say is I have a brain that is not neurotypical. It works in a different way to yours. The way I look at language, the way I process information, the way I read words, the way I experience my environment is entirely different to you. It is alien to you. So with that diagnosis, I can actually say, this isn't just a personality quirk. I can't change this. This is how I deal with the world. And I don't think I would get that otherwise.
Dean, thank you. Thank you very much for your thoughts on that. We've got Steve in Blackheath. What would you like to say?
James, hi. You're part of my manor, I think, from your childhood, aren't you?
This was where I was born, brought up, grew up, and that's where our London place is during the week. So a nice part of the world, Steve. Not quite as nice as North Essex, but there you go.
It's quite emotive today, James, to be honest. There's a lot of people sharing some real personal stories about their journeys and narratives. I'm sort of listening to lots of your speakers and just sort of thinking, wow, you know, there's 8 billion people on the planet and schools are trying to institutionalize into this, you know, in this narrative, and all of us are really different. And I just think that the education system, I think I should mention this, I was a deputy ed for I was in London schools for 20 years in Lewisham and Greenwich, so I've lived that secondary narrative of, you know, I said to your lady on the call, I'm very pro diagnosis but very anti-label, and now
explain what
stigmatized.
So I saw that on the little just ahead of your call, so pro diagnosis but anti-label. I think I like the sound of that, but I'm not sure I completely know what you mean by that. So help me understand.
Yeah, it's pretty reasonably self-explanatory. I mean, we need to, you know, I wasn't, I needed a Senko next to me, a special education needs coordinator at school, because obviously that wasn't my expertise. But those people are gold in schools, and you need these experts to diagnose behaviours, traits, etc., neurodiversity in as early way as you can. And what that does is give us a toolbox of understanding as educators to say, look, these are the interventions that we know about. But I think it's very complex and multifaceted. But I'm just going to flip this 180 and work backwards. One of one of the ladies spoke earlier, and she talked about working in a Pru, and then she was saying about her experiences working with 4-year-olds and boys sitting on the floor, etc. But if we flip that to the end point of parents' aspirations for their kids to go uni. I don't know if you've seen the stats at one of the leading Russell Group unis, but they've had 20 suicides in a 3-year period, right? So that then links to what is education and what is learning. And she said, your lady said, oh, yeah, but they're there to learn. Now, my question to all your listeners is, and to you, and it's a question, not an answer, is what is learning? And unless we kill the exam factory culture, nothing is going to change, James.
Steve, you're drifting into a fascinating topic, which I think is a bit bigger than we're going to be able to squeeze into the final 15 minutes of this hour. But I think the broader point about helping people understand themselves, helping their families understand, helping their friends, their peers, their teachers understand why people are the way they are, what they're good at, what they're not good at, how they learn, is really, really important. I also agree with you that avoiding the stigmatization is absolutely key, because it can be tough being a kid, even if it goes really, really well, and having something which is potentially emotionally a hindrance, a drag anchor, I think makes childhood harder. So, but how, once a diagnosis has happened, how do we avoid giving it a label?
Well, I just think it's the education on the education. It's separating the two. The diagnosis is massive. You have to diagnose. I've got mates now in their 50s who have been diagnosed with ADHD, and we used, not in a bad way, but we used to call our mates Smarties back in the day, because every time we had some sweets, it'd go crazy. But now we're informed, aren't we? We have education, which is informative to help us understand people's behaviour. And that previous call that you had, that gentleman, I mean, I felt for him. He's now aware of his brain. And that's the great thing about diagnosis. It's the awareness of self to say, look, this is who I am, and this is how I'm going to go and smash the world on my journey. But people are too quick to label. Look at setting in school, James. It's the same thing. Your top set, your brainy, your bottom set, your thick. That's not the truth, is it?
Well, we're drifting into some very interesting conversations about education policy and about how you'll know as well as I do that there is lots of research about how children often live up to the labels applied to them. I could talk for hours on this. Unfortunately, we don't have hours, and I've got to go to a break. Steve, thanks very much for your call. You're listening to me, James Cleverly, standing in for James O'Brien. More calls on the way, and you can get in contact with me. Call me on 0345 6060973. WhatsApp on the same number. The time is now 10:46.
LBC. Keeping your smile healthy. At Darwood & Tanner, it's our sole purpose and absolute obsession. Whether you're missing a single tooth or many teeth, our streamlined patient journey, world-class dental practitioners, and advanced implant technology will get you smiling again quicker, more comfortably, and in the least invasive way. Darwood & Tanner. For our most comprehensive, tailored, and complete dental implant treatment, visit darwoodandtanner.co.uk.
Zero, nada, zilch. When Vauxhall say 0%, they mean 0%. 0% APR is available now across the Vauxhall car range, including the all-new Frontera Electric. With a minimum 20% deposit and up to 4 years on offer, what's not to like? And now, for a limited time, get an extra £500 towards your new Vauxhall. Search Vauxhall to find out more. Personal contract purchase, 20% deposit, £500 contribution on new car orders between 23rd of August to 8th of September 2025. 18 plus, subject to status and availability, T's and C's, the Lancers Financial Services.
Just because you can't see something doesn't mean it isn't there. You can't hold this in your hand or pack it in your bags. You can't touch it. But our network is around you, like oxygen. Near or far, we're there. That's why we've been awarded Best Mobile Network Coverage by Uswitch. O2. Essential for living.
Based on OpenSignal Awards UK Mobile Network Experience Report, September 2024, to verify, see opensignal.com/UK Mobile Report.
Hey, Mum. So, you know we met Zara, my financial advisor?
Yeah.
Yeah, from St. James's Place. Well, she drafted our plan so you can get that bungalow near me.
Oh,
and Sam, that lovely carer we found, will drop in. And I can bring over my signature shepherd's pie. Hoi!
Big decisions call for invaluable advice.
Visit St. James's Place to find your one-to-one financial advisor. St. James's Place Wealth Management PLC is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. SJP approved 19th of Feb 25.
Canal Adventures in St. Pancras.
That's a new one for us.
Oh, kids, cafe's this way.
Oh, your heart out, Venice. This is lovely.
What's that?
Yes, I have both Captain Hats for the boat ride.
Train back.
So that was two pastries, one boat ride, and no tantrums. Result!
Love this shot of them driving the boat.
Download the Thameslink Railway app to book kids' tickets for £2 on off-peak journeys. Thameslink Railway, where every stop is a story. Terms apply. See our website for full details.
James Cleverly on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
You're listening to me, James Cleverly, on LBC, standing in for James O'Brien. We've got time for a few more calls on what we've been discussing through this hour, which is the possible overdiagnosis of children with the diagnosis that children have mental health disorders or special needs, and whether we're getting it right. Let's go to Frank in Carlisle.
Morning, James. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you, everyone.
To give you my context, I was a teacher in a school in Leicester from 2008 to 2016. And in that time, what changed was basically a cut in funding. Now, before this cut happened, we had a support team, learning support teachers. And they are the stars of the show. I'll always say this if I get on the radio. They are the people who make the school work. They're brilliant. And we'd have a group of people who would go around into classes with children who needed help. And then we'd have a couple of people sat in an office who you could send somebody down to if they needed some help, or you could call one of them out to help in a lesson. And they would help the people who you're probably thinking are like borderline cases here, the ones who maybe are, do have an EHCP now, but maybe wouldn't have had then. So why do they have it now? Because it's the only way you get funding. So as a school, you cut your coat according to your cloth. When we went through, and I'll put it online, austerity, when we had to take money out of our budget because the Building Schools for the Future was cancelled by Michael Gove, when that happened, we had to lay people off.
Hang on, Frank.
Because the
Building Schools for the Future, that was for capital investment, that was for literally building schools, that wasn't for paying for teachers. So I think you might, don't want to pull you up on this, but you seem to be blurring two different pots of money. But I hear the broader point that you're making about more general support rather than specific support. So here's a question for you. Would you think it were better that we focus less on specific diagnosis for specific children or EHCPs for specific children and had a more generalised pool of support that helped children and young people learn and experience education in the way that better suits them?
Yes, and I think if we had the funding to do that in a school, to have those people that you need just to pick up a bit of the spare space around the edges to help the people out who need a bit of help, but maybe not constant help, then you'd find you had a smoother process. And it would mean that people weren't trying to get their kids into private school because the SEN provision used to be enough, but now it is only targeted at those who have the documentation to say they need it, and those people are stretched very thin. I went back into teaching in 2020 for a couple of years, and I was very surprised to find that the SENCO, the SEN coordinator, she worked every hour she had, and a lot of her time was spent processing EHCP assessments and going through this because it was the only way that the school could get money in. Now, in previous schools, that role, that person, would be doing more than just the paperwork. It would eat into their hours and it would add to their stress. This is what we need. We need proper funding to support the people who can't just come into school every day and do the lesson. They may not need a statement. Some will, as we said, but I think there's a possibility that some of these people you're saying who are overdiagnosed, and I challenge that word, but if you're saying that they're overdiagnosed, part of the reason for that will be that that is the only way that they will get support because there is no funding if they're not.
Frank, thank you very much for your call. I'm going to go now to Philip in Milton Keynes. Philip, what are your thoughts on this?
So from my perspective, I don't think it's necessarily, there's not a need to be diagnosed. But I think the way that the UK needs to tackle it is different. So sending students out and taking them out of the mainstream schooling system and putting them into a special needs school, I don't think that's the right answer. And having spent time, I'm natively from the UK, I've spent, 15, 20 years here, 15, 20 years in the US. I have had kids in both systems. And my son in the US, when he was through what we would call middle school, a primary school over here, mm-hmm. he was diagnosed with mild autism and ADHD. The approach that we took then in the US was getting something called an IEP, which is a similar program. The difference is they then use that funding to allocate additional resource to the school that he's in to support him, which is similar to what the UK did 15, 20 years ago, where you'd have a teacher assistant in a room for students who we would class as non-typical learners. So I think we need to stay to that structure. And I've seen that be successful in the US with him. So he has now graduated high school, he is in university, and he's doing well. But it meant that he didn't feel like an outsider as a student, or like you said, he didn't feel not normal in that sense by having to go into a separate school from where he's already made friends, and friends that are local to him where we live, not seeing him in their traditional school setting. So I think in that way, we're actually making it harder for these students by separating them and making them not feel like they're part of the normal society, the normal community, which then has a greater impact later in life for them when they have to go into environments where we don't have these support systems like the working world and other things that we can't cater to them as much. And they don't learn social skills, how to interact, how to understand body language, which is not natural for them to understand it the same way non-diagnosed people would. And I think, therefore, we're actually hindering them for adult life by not allowing them to stay within the main system, but giving them support to actually support them in that environment.
Cool. Philip, thank you. Thank you for your call. I think I've got enough time to go to Gary in Beckenham.
Yeah, hi. Am I online?
You are indeed. Go on, Gary.
Hi, yeah. I'm a parent of an autistic child. A severely autistic child, and he's 37, he's in care. Mm-hmm. And I advocate for autism and parents that are still fighting to get their child diagnosed as autistic. I mean, most parents can probably diagnose it themselves. But to get it's a bit like the previous caller said that once you've got a diagnosis, you can obtain funding. And obviously the funding is restricted. And, I've got people been waiting 2 or 3 years just for an assessment.
Yeah.
And so I disagree with the fact that there's lots of people that aren't being diagnosed. That people are over-diagnosing totally. I think one of the biggest problems is that autism has a huge spectrum. And there are lots of people out there that have autism that can function normally.
So, Gary, that's I think, a very important point that you've just made. And I've got a special school in my constituency that does amazing work with a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful group of young people. But I'm also very conscious that the number of people, either with a diagnosis or an EHCP, has expanded massively, which is putting real pressure on the system. And I think sometimes it's making it a lot harder for children like yours and some of the children that I've met in my constituency to get the support they need as quickly as they need it, because the system's been overwhelmed by this massive expansion. And of course, everyone wants the best for their child. Of course you do. The question is, might the best thing for many of the children actually be a more inclusive, sympathetic and understanding learning environment rather than a specific diagnosis?
No, I disagree. No, I do. I mean, my son was being taught in a corridor initially a standard school because they couldn't handle him in the class. And then, we had to fight tooth and nail to get him into a special school. And, you know, he's ended up in the care system because, you know, he's severely autistic. You know, and I think there are lots of children out there that have the same. But the problem is that, yes, it has expanded, but I think the number of cases has expanded. I think there are more autistic people around today than there were 50 years ago.
So, quick question before we finish to you. And I know I'm asking you to, it's perhaps an unfair question because it's big data analysis. Do you think there are genuinely more people on the autistic spectrum, or that we are better at spotting?
No, I think there are more people now on the autistic spectrum.
Okay.
Absolutely. You know, the Bromley Autistic Trust and all the autistic trusts are overwhelmed with the number of people. And there are, like you say, there are lots of people out there that, you know, are on the autistic spectrum, and they don't need special education elite needs. You know, I think that you could almost say that virtually everybody is somewhere on the spectrum. You know, and it's whether or not you can define that bit where you do need or whether you don't need this special educational needs.
Yeah. Gary, look, thank you very much for your call, and indeed thank you to everyone that's called in through this last hour. I don't think we're going to get to a position where we get a unified position on whether we've got overdiagnosis or underdiagnosis, but I've heard from a lot of people who have found it frustrating or difficult or challenging getting the support that they want for their children, understandably want for their children. In the next hour, after the news, I'm going to be talking about how many children there are in society, because I don't think there are enough. Birth rates in England and Wales have fallen to their lowest levels on record. So we are not having enough children. And I want to understand why that is the case. So my question to you, dear listeners, is, have you postponed having children? And if so, why? You're listening to me, James Cleverly, on LBC. The time is now nearly 11:01.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom, rescue workers in the Ukrainian capital are searching for survivors after Russian strikes killed at least 15 people. Three children, including a toddler, are among the dead, while dozens more people are injured. Moscow insists it was targeting military factories and air bases. Oz Kataji, a journalist based in Kyiv, has been speaking to LBC.
I've just come back from the scene of the attack, particularly nasty attack on a Ukrainian apartment building. Half of it has been flattened. 598 drones, 11 ballistic missiles and 20 cruise missiles launched by Russia onto Ukrainian territory. So it was a very large-scale attack with the air defence working throughout the night very loudly above the skies of Kyiv.
The Court of Appeal is hearing the latest part of the legal battle over an asylum hotel in Essex. The Home Office and the owner of the site in Epping are trying to challenge a block on housing migrants there. An injunction was granted by the High Court last week. The BAFTA-winning actor Michael Ward has appeared in court charged with rape and sexual assault. The 27-year-old, best known for appearing in Top Boy, was granted bail at Thames Magistrates Court. He's previously rejected the allegations. The Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, has agreed to meet the families of stillborn babies buried in mass graves in England. An LBC investigation at the end of last year found nearly 90,000 infants had been buried in unmarked sites up until the late 1980s. Some parents spent decades trying to track them down. Mr. Streeting has told us he wants to speak to some of those affected.
I think the important thing is, and what I'm keen to do off the back of your journalism, is to also just now listen to what family groups are saying. I think it's really important that we hear from them what they've been through and anything we can do to help provide some healing. You know, I think we owe it to those families.
The National Residential Landlords Association has warned reported tax changes would only see rent go up. Treasury officials are understood to be looking at imposing national insurance contributions on landlords' rental income. Ministers have refused to be drawn on the report. In the city, the FTSE 100 a short time ago was trading at 92.59. That is up 3 points. The pound buys $1.34 and a euro 15. LBC weather, most places seeing some sunshine and scattered showers. The rain heavy and thundery at times, with the possibility of some hail, a high of 23 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Thomas Watts.
Some companies try to reel people in by promising quick cash if you pay them to claim work expenses. But think twice before taking the bait, because they might just want to land a commission, and it turns out you aren't eligible to claim anything. You'll have to pay HMRC back, and it's unlikely the company will refund any fees. So don't get caught out. Check if you're eligible and make a claim with HMRC for free online. Just search, don't get caught out.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with James Cleverly.
We are not having enough children. Good morning. You're listening to me, James Cleverly, standing in for James O'Brien here on LBC until 1 o'clock today. And I want to talk in this hour about the fact we are not having enough children. The fertility rate in England, in England and Wales, in 2024 was 1.41, while in Scotland the rate was 1.25. And you don't need to be a mathematician to understand that a rate below two means that the population is going to be declining. And there are a whole load of public policy and social implications of having a declining and therefore aging population. Now, I'm not going to go into all of the implications of that. That's a big and complicated conversation. There's a whole load of things about pension policy, tax policy, employment, etc., etc. What I want to concentrate on in the next hour, with your help and your calls, is why that fertility rate is at its lowest level on record. And the obvious answers, in my mind, but I want you to either confront my hypothesis on this, or perhaps even reinforce it, is that the cost of having children is increasing, that the fact that people are getting on the housing ladder later in life, and obviously a lot of people really only think seriously about starting a family once they've got on the housing ladder, whether that's in rented accommodation, stable rented accommodation, or whether they've got a mortgage, that the cost of childcare is very expensive, just the cost of living more generally is expensive, or that people want to focus on their careers, perhaps for longer than in previous years, and therefore are having children later in life, and therefore, by extension, as a society, we're having fewer children in general. A very interesting statistic is that there was a 14% increase in the number of babies born to fathers who are over the age of 60. I'm a bit torn on this. On the one hand, well done to those older gentlemen for still doing their bit to try and maintain a birth rate. So if you are an older father, perhaps I'd be interested in hearing from you. But why are we? Why are we leaving that family life later in life? And what could or should we do to change that? And if you've made a conscious decision to delay having children, or indeed if you've made a conscious decision to avoid having children entirely, I'm very keen to hear from you. Or perhaps you've just woken up one morning realizing that actually that family that you were thinking about having, perhaps you discussed having with your partner, just hasn't really happened yet. Are you an accidental late parent? Have you intended to start a family earlier in your life but have just not got round to it? What has delayed it? What distracted you? What were you so busy doing that you weren't busy getting busy starting a family? I really, really want to know because, as I say, there are a huge number of economic and social implications of having very low birth rates. I was over in Japan, both as foreign secretary and previously when I was a backbencher. And Japan has had a very low birth rate for much, much longer than we have here in the UK. And their society has, over time, changed and evolved so that people in Japan are working much later in life. You see old Japanese people still doing manual labour. I was in the streets of Tokyo, driving around in Tokyo, and you see older people doing roadworks. You see older Japanese people doing the kind of jobs that you would normally expect younger people to be seen doing. But the retirement age, the practical retirement age in Japan is having to be pushed back, pushed back, pushed back, because they have got an aging population and a declining population. So what might we need to do either to deal with that reduction in the birth rate or to avoid that reduction in the birth rate? We've got a caller straight out the traps here. Jack in Enfield, what are your thoughts on this declining birth rate and what should we do about it?
Hi, James, how are you doing? I think, well, for me anyway, there's a few things. So, A, cost of housing. So, for example, me and my girlfriend live in a one-bedroom flat, so there's no room for a baby. I mean, you know, we'd have to go in the loft at the present moment in time. So there's no room. There's practically no room. And also, so that's housing. Two, and the cost of housing, obviously, to get a two-bedroom house or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And the next one would be the job market's very competitive out there. This is more me. I'm dyslexic, so I find writing CVs and I find it difficult. And obviously, you know, it's very competitive. You have to say the right thing, not too much, and be very precise in what you're saying, you know, for the employer to even look at you. But that's more me specifically, you know. Sure. That's another way. Yeah, so I think that for me, they're the main thing. So the housing is more everybody. That can be everybody. And so for that, then I think there needs to be a massive building program like they did after World War II, for example. There was no money in the kitty, but we still managed to build all these homes. So I don't know why we can't do it now.
It's interesting that you make the point that the space to have kids is a really important one. And look, I don't want to pry, but I want to understand. I think the listeners would want to understand. Do you feel that you're close to perhaps being able to move into a slightly bigger place? Are you keen to have children? Would you, if you could get that additional space?
If I get this additional space, we would definitely be more open to it because, like I say, for us. Just the space is the first major problem because we're kind of walking over each other at the moment because we're in a one bedroom flat and for two people it's not enough, let alone three, you know. So.
And it's interesting you say that because you're in Enfield up there in North London, and actually mothers in London, according to the Office for National Statistics, mothers living in London had the highest mean age across all of the regions of England and Wales. So their average age is 32 and a half years, first year of motherhood in 2024. And the lowest age was in the northeast of England. And I think it's perhaps unsurprising that the difference in housing costs between London and the northeast of England may well have a role to play in that. Jack, thank you very much for your call. So the cost of housing there is clearly something that Jack feels is limiting his ability to start a family. The challenge of getting into a space big enough for family. Now, this is not all about me, but my mum and dad, I'm an only child, and my mum and dad had me whilst they were still living in the spare bedroom of my grandparents' house in Catford in southeast London. And as a child, we moved into a one-bedroom flat. And of course, it's tough. It is tough. And the fact that my parents were limited on space when I was a kid, I think is perhaps one of the reasons that I am an only child. At the time, they didn't have the money to get somewhere bigger, and that influenced their choices in terms of families. So I'm now Shadow Housing Secretary. I'm very keen to make sure young people can get on the housing market, but I don't want this to be dominated just about housing. If that is a big driver, then I want to understand that that is a big driver. But if there are other things as well, for example, if work pressure, are you thinking that when you're starting off in your career, when you're working your way up the greasy pole, that is the wrong time to take maternity leave or indeed paternity leave? Do you think that that would give you a disadvantage when you're competing with the other people at work? Do you think there's a stigma attached to wanting to start a family or have more than one child, more than two children? What is it that is driving this famine of babies that the statistics are indicating is now a problem? Call me up, tell me what's going on, and I want to hear your experience, but also your ideas. You're listening to me, James Cleverly. As I say, you can call me on 0345 6060 973. You can WhatsApp me on the same number, and you can text me on 84850. And the time is now 11:15.
This is LBC.
Wouldn't it be better if your insurance company rewarded you for renewing? At NFU Mutual, our insurance can be relied on, and that means we reward loyalty. As a car, home, farming or business customer, you get a saving on your renewal thanks to our mutual bonus. We do this so you can enjoy the more important things. No wonder 9 out of 10 customers choose to renew every year. For insurance you can rely on, join NFU Mutual today.
The advert looked genuine. A post from a household name, experts in money, a hot opportunity. They asked for a small amount. Promised a great return, took all I had, and then disappeared. Investment scammers are highly sophisticated, and every month, CEL talk to thousands of people like you who've fallen victim. Our experts can help recover your money, so head to celsolicitors.co.uk today.
Tell CEL.
Lost World Play Barn, Dragon Castle Children's Farm, Jumping Pillows, Wallabies, Rocky Stuff Play. Tommy Tractor Play Barn, Quadrapillar, Rowing Boats, Aldous Blaze, Meerkats, Honey Pot, Bears. Kids, put on your swimmers for Jungle Splash.
Yeah, let's go, Mum.
Right. Cannon Arena, Lemurs, Jungle Kingdom, Go-Karts, Wave Runner 2, Magical Wood and Cafe.
Nutcatch Adventure Park.
The sun rises on and on and on and on.
Book now at nutcatch.com.
This is LBC with James Cleverly. Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
You're listening to me, James Cleverly, standing in for James O'Brien. And in this hour, we are talking about declining birth rates. We are having, on average, fewer and fewer children. And I want to know why, which is why I am now going to go to Abby in Hatfield. Abby, what's your experience?
My experience, I've got two children myself. My first was born in 22 and the last one was 2024, so quite recently. And just the costs revolving around it all is if you haven't got someone who's earning quite well in your relationship, it's very hard to sustain. So I took statutory maternity pay with my first, and it's something around £600 a month, if that, or around that figure.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know who's able to live on that. You know, so that's one aspect of it. And also, you know, I've got two young children. If I was to put them both into nursery full time, it would cost around £4,000 a month, because we don't hit the bracket for and free childcare and that side of things. So it's having the means to be able to afford it all. It's a lot.
That point on childcare is a real bugbear of mine. And I've mentioned this in the past. We've got a weird situation where we have some of the most expensive childcare in Europe, that we subsidise people to help support childcare, but we subsidise the amount of money that we derive from the taxes of people like you that might otherwise have gone back into work. So let me just understand your situation there. Was it basically you were thinking that the cost of childcare wouldn't really be covered by how much you would earn if you went back to work? Is it right that you didn't go back to work after your second child?
I didn't go back to work, so just look after the children now, because it just wouldn't be worth it. There's no, what you're left with at the end, I'd rather have that time with my children myself and bring them up rather than have an extra £200 a month from going back to work. It's just not, the pros and the cons to it, it's just not worth me going back at this moment in time.
And did you think about this kind of stuff before you started your... And again, it's a difficult topic, because I'm feeling really intrusive. I'm prying into people's lives, but I'm interested, and hopefully, therefore, the listeners are interested. How much thought did you have about the cost of childcare, how much you were earning, how much you might earn, going back full-time, part-time? How much was that in your thinking? Or did you think, we want a family, we'll just go for it, and we'll try and make it work?
For me, I'm in a fortunate situation that we knew that with what my other half earns, we were in a position where I would be able to stop work and not do, we were looking at the cost and factoring it in, whether we were going to do nursery and things like that. But we're very fortunate we're in that position. However, I know for a lot of people, they're not. A lot of my friends haven't started families for this reason. I've got an older sister who's worked very hard at her career. She's now at quite a decent level in her career. She's 30. She's not sure if she wants to have kids, because it would mean her then sort of backtracking on what she's built up to. And again, the maternity pay and what you get just isn't substantial enough for.
Abby, thank you very much for sharing that with us. I'm going to go now to Charles in Haringey. Charles, what's your thoughts on this?
Hi, James. Well, I'm actually in a unique position in the sense that I made an active decision to, well, I wanted to have children quite young. Mm-hmm. By today's standards. I'm 25 now. However, when I found out that my wife and I were having a son, I was 23. And I remember being both excited and scared and just putting in a lot of late nights at work just to show that I am, that this isn't going to affect me. And this isn't going to affect my progression.
Did you feel that you were going to be judged or disadvantaged at work because of your choice to have kids? And if so, what gave you that impression?
Well, I think it's just the fact that people who don't have children at work, or young children where you need to be available, you need to do drop-offs, sometimes pick-ups. In our case, we don't really have family around, so the burden really falls on my wife and I.
Yeah.
And I was worried that not being available for certain opportunities, there might be that stigma that, oh, maybe you don't give Charles that job or that project because he needs to do drop-off at this time, he needs to leave the office at that time. And so while I was super excited about having my son, and he's one of the best things that's ever happened to me, second to my wife, it was a bit of a, I don't know, fear, anxiety. So I put in so many late nights just pushing and pushing. And even now, for example, I don't work on Thursdays. Thursdays are the day where he doesn't go to a childminder, so I'll look after him. But let's say there's something, an exciting project, I'll pay that extra cost for childcare that day so I can be in, so that it doesn't impact what people view That's my working ability.
That's, I think you've hit on a really interesting point about the kind of work-life balance and the reality of having children and balancing your commitment at work. So how do you think there's a compromise that you're having to make between being seen to be engaged, active, enthusiastic, a good employee or a good worker, and your family commitments? Do you think those are at odds, and who picks up this slack if they are at odds?
I objectively speaking, I think they are odds. I mean, as a person, I believe where there's a will, there's a way. However, my wife and I are in a unique, good position that we can both afford childcare, but that doesn't mitigate the issue of you still have to drop your child off. You still have to pick them up. The working day starts at 9. The childminder opens at 8:30. I think a brilliant solution was if we used all those subsidies and the money we're taking from taxpayers, invest it into creches and nurseries within the workplace, like they have in Parliament. That will really solve a lot of issues, because then you can come to work. You don't have to sort of make a diversion on your way to work, drop your child off. It's just you're all going to the same place. And if you're picking your child up, it's easier. You're all leaving from the same place.
Yeah, I think you do make a good point. There are always compromises when you're starting a family. But these numbers indicate that perhaps some of the sacrifices and compromises that people are making are a little bit difficult to juggle. Charles, thank you very much for the call. I'm going to go to Sam in Manchester. Tell us about your experience, Sam.
Hi, James. You okay? Thanks for having me on.
That's right. Go on.
First time call, so a little bit nervous. So basically, me and my wife, we had three children quite close together, mm-hmm. Just before and during COVID. And she was working just her full-time hours, but just earning over £1,000 a month. In the process of doing that and having the children, it was going to cost over £2,000 to send them all back into full-time childcare. So it was actually... It made more sense for her to be off with the children. I'm lucky enough to have a decent job, so I was able to work more hours and work the overtime to make up the shortfall. But it's understandable that a lot of people aren't able to do that, so I can see why people get put off.
Now, Sam, statistically speaking, you have over twice as many children as average. So you're doing your bit. You and your wife are doing your bit with regard to the fertility rate. Do you find that, whether it's childcare or anything else, is geared up now for smaller families? Because historically, a couple having three children would be very, very, very normal. Now, statistically, you are a larger family than average. Has that had implications, whether it's cost implications or practicalities that impact the decisions that you've made about your family?
Well, don't get me wrong, everything's more expensive having more children, so you've got to feed them, or if you want to go away anywhere, everything costs more money. But also, with my wife, she works in a school setting herself, so that makes a massive difference, being able to have the childcare during the holidays. So if you're having to have two parents that don't have the ability to have the time off, then it's going to cost more during the holidays for the school clubs as well.
That's an interesting point you've got there. So Sam, thank you for your call. I'm quite conscious that we're talking about fertility, we're talking about birth rates, we're talking about family commitments. We've heard from a number of men, which is good. But I'm also very keen to hear from women. We've got a message here from Evie. Remember, you can WhatsApp me on 0345 6060 973, and the message from Evie is, and I quote, "Parents are speaking more openly about parenthood, especially mothers, and they're honest about how hard it is and how they lose their identity. Women like me," she says here, she's 38, "want more than to have our lives revolve around a child for the next 18 years. I also am infertile, and the cost of IVF has had a huge impact, and the NHS only gives you one round. So that's a story about a personal challenge there. But there is, I think, questions about the expectation on parents. And let's be honest, there is definitely an imbalance between the expectation on fathers and the expectation on mothers. So I'm very, very glad that we've heard from men. I'm also really keen to hear from women. I'm going to jump quickly because it's someone from Braintree, my town, Braintree. Blake, tell me about your experience, please.
So both myself and my wife, like I say, live in Braintree, both in the 40% tax bracket, earn quite well and such. But it is just, you know, with the general cost of living, mortgages, bills, taxes, everything rising, it is just the state of looking at my wife going on a maternity leave and such like that, and then looking at childcare. It just looks so far out of our reach. And I'm in a better position now than my parents ever was. But yet, to have kids, it just seems so far out of our reach. We just don't see how we would be able to balance both not claiming off of the state as well as, you know, wanting to do it ourselves and go, right, let's start having children and, you know, start getting the birth rate up kind of thing.
So you're both in what, by tax purposes, is defined yep. as higher earners. So you're yes. both in the 40% tax bracket, and your feeling is that financially speaking, children are out of the question.
It's like, you know, we both earn, but then it's just, you look at the cost of, like, if we have a single child, for instance, the average cost in and around the area for reputable nursery and such, you're looking around £1,500 plus a month. So that alone, and then it'd be balancing that versus my wife going back to work, or versus the time she would be able to spend with a child. There seems to be no balance. It just seems far out of our reach. And if I was to then do it, and say she could, you know, don't have to go back to work, and I was to be a sole income, meeting mortgages, cost of living, everything else going up, it just seems like an ever-ending, like the goalposts are moving.
Okay. Blake, thank you. Thank you for your thoughts on that. You're listening to me, James Cleverly. There are going to be more calls on the falling birth rates here in the UK, and I want to hear your experience, your thoughts, your ideas. You can call me on 0345 6060973. The news headlines now at 11:31 with Thomas Watts.
Sir Keir Starmer has accused Russia of sabotaging hopes of peace after a wave of strikes in Ukraine. Four children are among at least 15 people killed in overnight missile and drone attacks on Kyiv. Two men have denied charges related to the alleged rape of a 12-year-old girl in Nuneaton. The 23-year-olds, who are reportedly Afghan asylum seekers, have appeared at Warwick Crown Court. The Court of Appeal is hearing the latest part of the legal battle over a migrant hotel in Essex. The Home Office is trying to challenge an injunction stopping the site in Epping being used to house asylum seekers. LBC weather, sunshine and scattered showers for many. The rain will be heavy and thundery at times, with the possibility of some hail. A high of 23 degrees.
LBC.
The Harwoods upgrade event starts on the 4th of September. Upgrade your car with our bespoke offers to a new 75 registration at Harwoods Audi Southampton and Portsmouth, or a premium used model at Harwoods Assured Chichester. Find out more at harwoods.co.uk. But don't delay. The event ends Sunday the 7th. Harwoods, family owned since 1931.
The seagull says, your IKEA food favourites are now available in Brighton. Meatballs, plant balls, fish and chips. All delicious. Especially the chips. Yum.
IKEA Brighton, open 14th of August. IKEA, the wonderful everyday.
The advert looked genuine. A post from a household name, experts in money, a hot opportunity. They asked for a small amount, promised a great return, took all I had, and then disappeared. Investment scammers are highly sophisticated, and every month, CEL talk to thousands of people like you who've fallen victim. Our experts can help recover your money, so head to celsolicitors.co.uk today.
CEL. Lost World Play Barn, Dragon Castle Children's Farm, Jumping Pillows, Wallabies, Froggy Soft Play. Tommy Tractor Play Barn, Quadrapillar Rowing Boats, Owl Displays, Meerkats, Honey Pop Bears. And four giant slides on the brand new Wave Runner 2. Let's plunge!
What's next, Dad?
Cannon Arena Lemurs, Jungle Kingdom Go-Karts, Trampolines, Magical Wood and Cafes.
Nutcatch Adventure Park.
The sun goes on and on and on and on.
Book now at nutcatch.com.
James Cleverly on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
You're listening to me, James Cleverly, standing in for James O'Brien on LBC, and we're discussing falling birth rates. And I'm going to go now to Matt in Birmingham to share your experience. Matt.
Morning, James. Can you hear me clear
yes.
enough?
Booming through, yeah. Mate. Booming through.
So, so in regards to birth rates and in regards to my own experience, so me and my wife, our daughter is through IVF due to health reasons. But the reason we can't have another is because we can't afford. We would love to have another child, we would, but we just cannot afford to go through the IVF route. So if the government could kind of put together a plan and a scheme to actually allow parents who actually want another child or the first child, second, through IVF, that would increase the actual birth rate.
And how much, to give our listeners some kind of idea, I mean, how much does it cost to go through a round?
We were lucky.
IVF?
So it was 2018, so the NHS was still relatively okay. So we got it through the NHS. We were so, so lucky. And we got it for, we hit first time, we did. So we didn't have to go through for a second or third.
Really glad.
And it's all postcode lottery. It's all wrong. It is. So if you're in one part of the country, you were given two shots. If you're in another part of the country, you were given three shots or one shot where we were. So it's completely wrong. So if the government want to really do something and tackle this, the first step is to allow IVF because the declining in women's health, and I'm not going to name names, companies, everything, but there was a report out, and they are investigating with women's products and having heavy metals in. I'm not saying that they do. I'm just saying there is speculation out there that the companies that do tampons and that, they add heavy metals into it, and that's been a factor in declining women's health.
Okay.
I'm not saying they're out there doing it. I'm just saying that there is talk about it.
Sure.
And yeah.
And how
in regards to it?
And how are you finding the cost of actually having a family now?
Now this gets me every time. Yes, children are expensive. We sent my daughter to holiday club over the summer period. That was over £300-£400 it was for a couple of weeks it was, and we went on holiday and stuff like that, but it's really expensive. But you do account for it, so anyone who's thinking of having kids and they're scared of the cost of it, don't be, because you'll adjust your own situation to the child, you will, and it is affordable because you can make it affordable.
Matt, thank you very, very much. I've got a WhatsApp message that I want to read out. And I'm interested to hear from you if you agree. This is from Nishant, I hope I'm saying that right, who says, "Hi, James. I made a conscious decision not to have kids due to the bleak picture that climate change is painting for us." The WhatsApp goes on to say, and I can't, I'm not going to try and verify these figures. 2024 was the hottest year on record. 2025 saw a record number of wildfires in the UK. 2022 saw temperatures above 40 degrees Celsius for the first time in the UK. Floods, droughts, cost of living and so many other reasons, there's no point in bringing another human into this world so that they can suffer with us. Sorry to be so negative and pessimistic, but that is my reality. I find comments like that genuinely heartbreaking, because we've got someone there who sees a really negative outlook, not just on their life, but on the life of future generations. And that is the driving factor for them not having children. Do you think that Nishant is right, is wrong, is seeing the world too bleakly? What's your views on this? Do you share that assessment of the future? And is that holding you back from having children? Back now to a caller. Martine in Harold Hill, what would you like to say?
Hello. Hi, James. How are you? So I've got one child through, he's not IVF, but I went through 5 rounds of IVF. And in my perspective, it's not just about the cost of living. It's about having the support from your family. So, for example, I don't send my son to nursery. He's one. Thankfully, I've got my nan, my mum, and my mother-in-law, believe it or not, that look after my son when I go to work and when my partner's at work. But if you don't have that support and you can't afford childcare, what are you meant to do?
That's a really interesting point, Martine. So you've got a family network around you.
Yeah, thankfully.
Yeah, and that through most of human history has been how things have worked. Now, obviously, in the modern world, we can't replicate the lifestyles that we had in previous centuries, and I'm not necessarily suggesting we would. But for you, having that family wraparound has been the difference between being able to make it work. And are you suggesting if that wasn't the case, you wouldn't have been able to make the maths work?
Well, we always discussed about having one baby anyway. But we've discussed about having another, and we've kind of just said no, because we don't know how, not only how we feel about it, but how a family would feel about looking after two children instead of one. Because we've got to take into consideration that our mums and nan are a little bit older now. They've done their kids and whatever, whatever. It's just taken everyone else into, accountability as well. And also, it is the cost of living. Like, being able to afford another child right now, we are comfortable in what we're earning and how we're going and our living. But if we add another baby into it, we don't know where we would be. We don't know if it would affect us dramatically or whether it would not really affect us at all. But we don't want to take that chance and that risk, because right now we're comfortable and we want to give our son a life. That's sort of how we're looking at it.
That's really interesting. Martine, thank you. I'm going to read out another quick WhatsApp message, and then I'm going to go to another caller before we get to the quarter of an hour point. This is from Fergus, who says, "Hi, James. My partner and I agree with your last texter who was speaking about climate change." Fergus goes on to say, "We have instead decided to go through the fostering process in order to help a child who's already in the world rather than having one of our own." Much love, Fergus. A huge amount. I've always got a huge amount of respect for people that do fostering and adopting of children. But again, someone there concerned about the geopolitics and the environment and the big picture and the impact that's having on the most, I think perhaps the most personal and intimate of decisions. I'd like now to go to Rahana, who's in Helensburgh in Scotland. Rahana, what's your experience?
Hiya. So I'm actually a mum of four, and my kids range from 8 to 1. Mm-hmm. So very much in the thick of early parenting. And I think a lot of what you've spoken about is so relevant, because there's definitely the climate aspect. There's definitely the geopolitical aspect to it. And there's also the finances. And we're really lucky that my partner is able to have a job that means that actually I'm not working, or I'm self-employed but not doing a lot of work at the moment. But we've looked at it and thought, actually, between having neurodivergent kids who have additional needs, school meetings, doctor's appointments, and even just things like if your kid gets sick,
you know, that would then impact one parent going into work. So looking at the finances, looking at the reality that children aren't robots and they can't time when they're going to get sick to the school holidays or anything like that, or to your leave, we've chosen for me to stay at home for the moment until the kids are a bit older.
And your career enables you to do that. And I say career rather than job, because one of the things that I have heard, not necessarily through the calls today, but I'll be interested to hear if this fits with people's experience, is that in a competitive working environment, and it shouldn't be like this, but nevertheless, this is how often people feel, that whether it's maternity leave or paternity leave, if you're being seen to not be as committed to your career as some of the people you're working with, that is going to have a massive detrimental effect. Has that played a part? Is that something that has impacted your family, to you, or to people that
absolutely,
you know?
Absolutely, absolutely. So I definitely think that's played a part with my partner's career, to the point where for our first child, he didn't get to take paternity because it would have been seen as him then not prioritising his career. But with me, because I'm self-employed and I work within the birth space anyway, I can pick and choose where I want to work and what I do, which is a massive privilege.
And that flexibility you're suggesting is, and that's why you're able to have four children, which again, statistically means you're very much in a minority when it comes to the size of your family. But it's the flexibility around your work specifically rather than your partner's work?
It's both, because his work and the fact that he earns enough for me to be able to stay home with them means that we've got that option. Because if he was in a different job, he's in the military, but if he was in a different job, then maybe we would have to look at me going into work, and then we might not have had the third and fourth child.
I think this is, and maybe we discussed this in the last quarter of an hour of this hour, but there is definitely something there about having structures that enable choice. And I'd be very, very keen to hear from people who feel that they have created a structure, or there is a structure that has enabled them to choose to have a larger family, or if that support structure is not in place, and that is what is limiting them. So we'll talk about this more in the next quarter of an hour. You're listening to me, James Cleverly. If you want to get in on this topic, please make sure you get in touch. Your views on falling birth rates, how it affects you, what we could do about it. And the time is now 11:46.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
Reeves eyes tax raid on landlords to raise £2 billion. This is the economics of the madhouse from this government. I am not here to defend Rackman-like landlords where you're forced to live with rats or mould and dangerous boilers. All that will happen is landlords will flog the houses, which helps none of the tenants, and those that are still in there, they will actually increase, because the basic law of economics is if more properties are sold, fewer are available for rent, they can put up the prices. The Chancellor, really, she does seem to struggle with her sums.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast, back tomorrow morning from 7. Listen on your radio, on Global Player, and the new LBC app.
Arenas full of fans. Stars taking it to another level. The excitement, the glory, the action. And you could be behind it all. Kickstart your career in esports with Global Academy's new esports production sixth form course. Get the skills and knowledge to join a fast-growing media industry. And you could even join Global Academy's own esports team. Thinking what next after GCSEs? Then find out more about the esports production sixth form course at globalacademy.com.
Just because you can't see something doesn't mean it isn't there. You can't hold this in your hand or pack it in your bags. You can't touch it. But our network is around you, like oxygen. Near or far, we're there. That's why we've been awarded Best Mobile Network Coverage by Uswitch. O2, essential for living.
Based on Open Signal Awards, UK Mobile Network Experience Report, September 2024, to verify, see opensignal.com/UK Mobile Report.
Hey, Dad.
Hey, love. Just spoke to Zara from St. James's Place.
Your financial advisor?
Yeah, we've made a plan. Retire early, travel more.
Peru first.
Ooh, ¿cómo estás?
Bless you. And Zara's plan means I can help more with your house deposit.
Thanks again, Dad.
Planning for the future calls for invaluable advice. Visit St. James's Place to find your one-to-one financial advisor. St. James's Place Wealth Management PLC is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. SJP approved 19th of Feb 25.
Train to Pevensey Bay. Beach, mates, cooler. Oh,
Danny, you got the hummus, yeah?
Of course.
Now this is what it's all about. Time to relax.
Huh? Frisbee? No, you two crack on.
Just made the train. Now home to over half the beach from my bag. 10 out of 10 day, though.
Download the Southern Railway app to book tickets and save a third off group travel and off-peak journeys. Southern Railway, where every stop is a story. Terms apply. See our website for full details.
I'm Taz. I've been part of the dental hygiene therapy team here at Darwood & Tanner for nearly 20 years. At Darwood & Tanner, we know the importance of ongoing maintenance and long-term care. This is a crucial part of our dental implant treatments, so you can be sure we're here to keep you smiling for many years to come.
A team of dental experts second to none, armed with the very latest in dental implant knowledge, technology, and techniques. Visit darwoodandtanner.co.uk.
James Cleverly on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
You're listening to me, James Cleverly, standing in for James O'Brien here on LBC. And until 12 o'clock, we are going to take a couple more calls on birth rates, fertility rates and your experience. And then after that, I want to talk to you about how the German government is trying to increase the number of people volunteering for their military. And I want to know, would you volunteer to fight for Britain? And if not, why not? But first, let's go back to your calls on families and birth rates and fertility. Let's go to Kelly in Gloucester. What are your thoughts, Kelly?
Hi there. Well, I'm a mum of three boys. I'm now 38. I'm currently not working, but when we had our first little boy, we could not afford childcare. My other half had just started a career, pretty much bottom of the ladder. We were renting, trying to then afford a property. So what I kind of had to do is kind of give up my career or any idea of a career and just try and find a job that suited for the hours so we didn't have to pay childcare. And that kind of led me to working at nights in social care, but sleeping in. So I kind of was awake for a few hours and then I would sleep for most of it unless there was any kind of disturbance. And then it would allow me to kind of finish work in the morning, run back for my little one so I could be there with them during the day and my other half would go to work. And that kind of went on for a long time. You're talking almost 10 years. And then we then had two other little boys, but we've had to save so much money, paid roughly about 30,000, I think, in IVF, because we weren't suitable for the NHS, basically. I'm now currently not working. So I'm not surprised that people aren't having as many children.
Kelly, I had two boys. You said you got three boys. I had two boys. And I am very conscious that my wife, Susie, did a disproportionate amount of the childcare, which is not massively unusual. You've just told me that basically, even though at times you were able to sleep, you basically worked through the night to go home during the day to look after your son, your eldest son. How on earth did you manage to do that?
Stay
awake.
I look back and I think, I don't know how I did it. I mean, I was younger, I was in my 20s then. I managed it for a bit. And don't get me wrong, I got a bit of relief when it was time for school. But because it was kind of time for school, I could kind of go and earn that little bit more. So I actually did night shift, come home, take him to school, get about 4 hours sleep, go pick him up, do tea, and then my other half would come back and I'd be straight out to do night shift again. So I've had it quite, I would say hard, but it's been manageable. But it just made sense back then because childcare was just costing so much, and I just thought, okay, I'm going to give up the idea of a career, and I'm just going to do what I can. And then, nearly 10 years later, we've had another two boys. So,
congratulations on that. Congratulations
Thank you.
On that. Is the eldest So 10 years, a little bit young to help out with the childcare for the two new... Are they still babies, yes. The two?
Yeah, so I've got a 2.5-year-old and a 6-month-old. So it's busy. He's very mature, but yes, too old to kind of help out. So that's why, you know, we have had to save a lot of money to be able to have more children and to kind of be able to financially support ourselves now and me not work. It has been a lot, but we're now at the point where I can do that a bit more comfortably. But it feels like it's going to be nearly 20 years worth of just trying to kind of figure out childcare, basically, because it is so expensive. I understand why people aren't having children, because it is a choice where you feel like you kind of have to give up quite a bit of yourself. It's a lot.
And would you say, just before we finish chatting with each other, would you say the childcare costs were the most significant factor in your thinking, more so than housing costs or the other costs involved with bringing up a family?
Yeah, I think the costs were a huge thing, especially for a young family. You know, in your 20s, if you're starting a family, the costs are so, there's so much, and then you have to make a choice between covering those costs, which is then pointless in going to work, and then also giving up seeing your child. So it's such a, you're just so torn, and in the end you think, well, if I'm paying that amount of money out, then I may as well just be off and enjoy that time with my child, because I'm only going to get that once. So you make that choice. But I managed to wangle it over them years and just try and get any job I could just to be with my children and not have to pay the childcare, and for us to still financially be able to kind of, you know, move up the ladder and things and own our own property and, you know, everything that you want for a family when you start one.
Kelly, thank you very much for that. I'm going to go now to Erin in Reading. Erin, what's your experience?
Hi, so I am a young woman in my 20s, and like most women in my situation, I've thought about it a lot. I thought, should I, shouldn't, going back and forth between whether or not I want to have children. And I think it is such a big decision to make, especially in the day and age that we're in now. I'm with a very loving partner. We both discussed it, and I think we would make incredible parents. But the way that society is currently set up, it's just not a situation that we feel like it would be possible, even in the next, you know, 5 or 10 years. Maybe things will change, but who knows? I think because I've just finished my master's degree, I'm very early on in my career, but I have a career that, you know, I'm trying to start one that I'm very passionate about.
Mm-hmm.
My partner has been in his career for 8 years and is also very passionate about what he does. And to be a parent, everybody knows you need to compromise something, but it's about deciding who is going to compromise and, like, why should we do that? You know, I want to work. I want to do my job. I don't really want to give that up, which is, yeah, something that I'd have to compromise on.
Do you think that, can you envisage a route to circumstances where you could or would start a family? Have you got a plan? Have you got a roadmap? Or is it the kind of, you'll do a little audit periodically to see whether you think you're ready?
I think I would see over time to see if I'm ready. But also, I have thought about it, and it would probably be the case that one of us would have to be able to afford childcare, or one of us would have to be able to work a job where we could either each do part-time and share it. But it's, life is so expensive, and the world is not really a great place either. So that's another reason to not bring children into the world. The climate change, the economical and political sort of side of it, you know, it's a difficult place to be.
So it's an economic concern, but also a broader concern about the state of the world at the moment.
Yeah, state of the world, if we want to bring a child into the world, and then what are we going to do with the child? Is one of us is going to have to stay at home with it, or one of us is going to have to give up our career, or one of us is going to have to spend loads and loads of money on that as well? And, you know, I watched what my mother had to go through. You know, she was a single parent, so I know how difficult it can be. You know, even having two parents, it would be a lot easier, but still not what you want it to be.
Sure.
And also, another thing that I was thinking is that with the rise in social media, I think a lot more women are aware of what your body actually has to go through in order to go, like, have pregnancy and go through childbirth. And I think information sort of prevents us from wanting to go through that.
Yeah, well, there was a thank you, Frank. Eric. When Susie was pregnant, there was a book called What to Expect When You're Expecting. It's a very famous book. I was never a fan. It's a good book. I was never a fan because there's a small section at the beginning which basically says, in a normal pregnancy, this is what happens. And then about three quarters of the book are all the various different ways it can go wrong, which can be quite off-putting, even though most pregnancies, of course, work out fine. I'm going to quickly go to Gisela in Plymouth before we finish on this topic. Gisela.
Oh, hi, James. Yeah, so my daughter is 17 and a half, so I had her back in 2008. I never wanted children up to that point, but I got to 33 and I felt like I wanted to have a child then. I did become a single parent, but as time's gone on, I've just seen how things have become quite negative. Things felt quite positive back then, and things don't feel like, it feels like everything's going backwards in the country. So views towards women, views towards the environment, and even on a bigger scale through the world, you know, encroaching on the natural world and the resources, and so many people starving around the world. And I kind of think, even though I've got my daughter, and I wouldn't have it any other way. I worry about her future. She does want to have children in the future. We have lots of conversations about things, but she, I worry about the future and the politicisation in this country. It's so volatile, and yeah, there's many different reasons. And I think also previous women have said the whole childcare issue. I was very lucky. My parents looked after my daughter when I went back to work. But I think had I not had them around or near, I don't know how I would have managed.
Gisela, so you've got a daughter, and perhaps over the next few years she'll be thinking about starting a family of her own. And you mentioned there about help and support. Do you think you would be in a position as a future grandmother to help out your daughter with childcare?
I'd like to think so. I'd like to think that I was well enough and healthy enough. Obviously, I had her when I was 34, so I'm now 52. So obviously, I was an older mum at the time. I'd like to think that I would be in a position where I could help her out, but you don't know what's around the corner. But I would be trying to help her and her future partner where I could. But I worry about just how everything is going, and everything feels very volatile and angry and polarizing, and I find it quite scary at the moment. And whereas when back in 2007, when I decided to have a child, everything felt like it was going in the right direction. Sure. And everything felt quite positive. But it doesn't feel like that now, unfortunately.
Gisela, thank you for that, and thank you for your calls over the last hour. So there's some real practical considerations that people have discussed, the out-of-pocket costs, childcare costs and various other things about having children, but also a number of people there saying that there's clouds on the horizon, that they're just worried. They're worried about the world that they'll be bringing children into. And that is having an impact. I wonder how much is amplifying the concerns about the practical costs of having children. Please call in. In the next hour, we're going to be talking about military service. German government wants more Germans to volunteer for the armed forces. Would you volunteer for the British armed forces? Would you fight for your country? I want to know. So I'll be back in a couple of minutes, and the time now is 12:02.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC,
leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom, Sir Keir Starmer has accused Russia of sabotaging hopes of peace by killing children and civilians in Ukraine. At least 15 people, including three children, have been killed in a wave of missile and drone attacks on the capital of Kiev. An EU delegation office and the British Council building were damaged. Jimmy Rushton, a security analyst based in Kiev, says it was a scary night.
Even though the closest was about 2 kilometres from me, the blast wave was strong enough that it was setting car alarms off in my district, shaking windows, and you had flashes of the explosions, like kind of a thunderstorm from hell, really.
It's understood the Foreign Office has summoned the Russian ambassador. The latest stage of the legal battle over the Epping Asylum Hotel is being held at the Court of Appeal. The Home Office and Somani Hotels, which owns the site, are seeking to challenge a High Court injunction. It'll stop dozens of asylum seekers from being housed at the Bell Hotel. Two men charged in connection with the alleged rape of a 12-year-old girl in Nuneaton have pleaded not guilty to all charges. The 23-year-olds, who are reportedly Afghan asylum seekers, appeared at Warwick Crown Court this morning. The case led to claims of a cover-up by authorities over the suspect's immigration status. The BAFTA-winning actor Michael Ward has appeared in court charged with rape and sexual assault. The 27-year-old, best known for appearing in Top Boy, was granted bail at Thames Magistrate Court this morning. He's previously rejected the allegations. LBC's reporter Helen Hodinott has more details.
The 27-year-old is accused of committing the offences against one woman in January 2023. Dressed in a dark suit, the Jamaican-born actor living in Chesson in Hertfordshire spoke only to confirm his name, date of birth and address during the brief hearing today. No pleas were entered and the case was sent to Snaresbrook Crown Court for a further hearing on the 25th of September.
None of the main childhood vaccines in England reached the 95% uptake target last year. Just under 92% of five-year-olds had received a dose of MMR, remaining at its lowest level since 2010. London had the lowest regional figure at below 70%. In the city, the FTSE 100 a short time ago was trading down 42 points at 92.13. The pound buys $1.35 and a euro 15. LBC weather, sunshine and scattered showers for many this afternoon. The rain will be heavy and thundery in places with the possibility of some hail, a high of 23 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Thomas Watts.
Pump six in this meal deal, please.
Let's play Rate My BP Meal Deal.
OK.
You chose an M&S chicken and bacon pasta, Magnum ice cream and a Wild Bean Cafe iced latte. That's a 10. A perfect warm weather combo.
Ever won a holiday?
No. BP Meal Deal. One deal, millions of combinations. All for £6.
T's and C's apply, subject to availability at BP M&S stores only. For details, see bp.com/latest offers.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with James Cleverly.
Good afternoon. You're listening to me, James Cleverly, and I'm standing in for James O'Brien here on LBC, and I'll be with you until 1 o'clock. In this hour, I want to talk about military service. Now, I think I should declare an interest here. I'm a member of the Reserve Forces, have been for most of my adult life. But I'm not speaking to you in that capacity. I'm speaking to you now as a radio host. And I want to talk about a decision that Germany has recently taken. So the German cabinet, and it's a coalition cabinet in the German political system, but the German cabinet have passed a bill which is designed to increase the numbers of people in the German armed forces. Now, they are looking to introduce a voluntary six-month scheme which will increase the number of full-time soldiers ultimately, but also increase the number of trained reservists from the current level of around 100,000 up to a target of, I think, 200,000 reservists. Now, it's worth bearing in mind that Germany had conscription, mandatory military service, until 2011. They moved away from that, but now the defence minister, Boris Pistorius, is keen to get the number of soldiers in the or the number of people in the German military up from 180,000 to 260,000 by the early 2030s. And what's driving this? Unsurprisingly, the big driver of this, as Pistorius said in a press conference on Wednesday, the international security situation and, above all, Russia's aggressive posture makes this necessary. So the German government is making it very clear that Russian activity is what is driving their desire to increase the German armed forces. I've been to Eastern Europe, I've been to the Baltic states, I've been to Poland, indeed I've been to Ukraine on a number of occasions. And it is really clear that the further east you go across Europe, the closer you get to the Russian border, the more acute the concerns are about Russian aggression. Now, we're on the western edge of Europe, and we're very conscious of the implication of Russia's brutal invasion, full-scale invasion of Ukraine. But I don't think we feel it as viscerally as our friends and allies on the eastern flank of NATO, who in some instances have a land border with Russia or are closer to Russia than we are. They really feel it. And it percolates right the way through society. It's not just something that is thought about or talked about at government levels. It's the kind of thing that people discuss more generally. So I can see why the German government wants to increase the number of people in their armed forces. And the reason they're taking action is because after they scrapped conscription, unsurprisingly, the numbers of people joining the German armed forces was in a gentle decline, and they're seeking to reverse that. Now, in the UK, we got rid of conscription many decades ago. We've always, I think, as a nation, been proud of the fact that we have a volunteer armed force, and that is something that has served us well for quite some time. But many people think the game has changed really fundamentally after Russia's brutal full-scale invasion of Ukraine, that things are different, and so we have to act differently. And I know that the Secretary of State for Defence, the heads of the armed forces, the various service chiefs are all keen to increase the number of people in uniform, ready and willing to defend this country. So my question for you is a simple one. Would you be willing to volunteer to defend this country? Would you be willing to put on a uniform and, if necessary, fight to defend the values that we hold dear here in the UK? It's not for everybody, and if you think that is something that you would not be willing to do, why is that? Why would you not be comfortable defending a nation like ours, based on democracy, liberalism, the rule of law? I'm genuinely keen to know. One of the things that I was very proud of when I was Foreign Secretary is the work that I did with a number of others to help two countries in particular join NATO. Sweden and Finland, both of which are countries much closer to Russia than us. Indeed, Finland has an extensive land border with Russia, sought to join NATO as a direct response to Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And as Foreign Secretary, I helped in a small way to make that happen, which is why I'm very interested to take the first call before we go to the break from Simeon, who is, if I'm right, calling in from Tampere in Finland. Simeon, how are you?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Good. Tell me your thoughts on this.
Yeah, well, obviously Finland has conscription, so
most people wouldn't really get asked if they were willing to fight. The vast majority of people, however, would fight. If you look at surveys of countries, when people ask, would you fight for your country, Finland's always, if not at the very top of the list, and certainly the top three in Europe. Just half an hour ago, funnily enough, the government proposed raising the age of reservists by 5 years to increase their military, well, capacity, if you want to say that, defence capacity. And, basically Finland has a very strong sense of defending the country.
And do you feel that the actions that Germany has taken are inevitable, are the right move? And indeed, from I don't know how much experience you've had interacting with Brits, do you think there's the same sense? You're saying there's a very acute feeling about the importance of national defence in Finland. Do you think we have that in the UK? Are we in a similar place emotionally?
I can't really comment on that. I mean, I did my uni in Scotland, so I've got some experience in the country, but it's not like we talked about fighting for your country that much, unfortunately.
Better things to do when you're a student, I think.
Yeah, certainly.
And so you're coming towards the... Did you say you're coming towards the end of your time of compulsory military service? Is that right?
Yeah, correct. Yeah, technically...
Go on.
Oops, sorry. Yeah, in Finland you've got the option of either doing military service or you can do civil service, which is, you know, you go around helping schools, non-governmental organisations, non-profits, stuff like that. So you can choose. And I'm doing the latter, so I'm not doing military service.
Right, so it is a national service, as in a service
exactly.
to the nation, but it is not military service. And I think sometimes, actually, in the conversations that we've had here in the UK, the distinction between service to the nation and military service is sometimes lost. Simeon, thank you very much for your call. I want to continue this, and I'm particularly keen to hear if you're passionate about serving the nation in a military context, or if you're passionate about not serving in a military context. So I want to hear both sides of the argument. I want to understand what people think, whether you think that I am overreacting, whether you think that Germany is perhaps overreacting with this desire to have a stronger military. I want to hear your thoughts. So please do call in. You're listening to me, James Cleverly, and you can get in contact with me on 0345 6060973, where you can either call or WhatsApp. And the time is now 12:15.
LBC.
1.49 at McDonald's gets you a mini Oreo McFlurry. 1.49 on a big night out gets you...
Sorry, no trainers.
McDonald's save a menu. Actually get your money's worth. From 11 a.m. Price and participation may vary. Fees apply to delivery. Subject to availability.
The seagull says, your IKEA food favorites are now available in Brighton. Meatballs, plant balls, fish and chips. All delicious. Especially the chips. Yum. IKEA Brighton, open 14th of August. IKEA, the wonderful everyday.
If you bought a home on a holiday park in the UK, what you thought you were getting may not be what you ended up with. From unexpected site fee increases, running costs, a huge depreciation in value, many owners feel they've been missold. If you think this might be you, holidayparkadvicecentre.co.uk could help you receive the compensation you're entitled to. Text ASSIST to 78900 to find out more. That's ASSIST to 78900.
Get a step closer to winning a huge £20,000. Enter now at winplus.co.uk. Winplus, great prizes, real winners. 18 plus, GB only, T's and C's apply.
James Cleverly on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
You're listening to me, James Cleverly, here on LBC, and we're talking about military service. And would you be willing to volunteer to defend your country, defend this country, in a military context. And I'm going to go to Jules in Mepham. Jules, what are your thoughts on this?
Hi, James. I would like to say that I have two young daughters, 16 and 13, and I, since the day they were born, were like, maybe they'll be good, maybe they'll follow in my footsteps. And as they progress through life, their interests lie elsewhere and their specialities lie elsewhere. And if I could see them in the armed forces, I would see them in a background role, in an administration type role, as opposed to being a frontline soldier. I myself was a former Royal Marine of 18 years, and the longest serving colleague that I know of has just the end of last year completed 44 years. So there is a long-term career there, especially now when there's lack of numbers. But I think also today, the youth of today has got a totally different attitude and outlook on life, which is why we're currently struggling with retention after 5 years, where they're now looking at the armed forces as a stepping stone in a career. And the other downside and negative, well, there's three things. First thing is taking away the 22-year pension, which was a big drive for recruitment. Multiple redundancies over the years, which basically made the armed forces then look like a normal career, so why would I want to do 22 years? And the third one, more importantly over the last few years, has been the prosecution of veterans from Northern Ireland.
So, I mean, you've touched on a number of points there about why you think that a military career, a long-term military career, is less appealing a prospect than it once was. With regard to your two daughters, obviously there are some elements of military activity. You're in the Royal Marines, you know, coming off a landing craft or coming out of a helicopter, kicking indoors. There is always going to be that element to it, but there's increasingly, of course, in this day and age, a whole load of much less physical, much more technical things. Do you think that getting young people perhaps to volunteer in those less physical, less kinetic bits of military service might square the circle, give your girls and others some of that kind of structure and sense of purpose that I'm detecting that you got from your military service, but not necessarily being as physical as the career that you had had?
I do, and I think for me, if we were to have more engagement in schools with the armed forces, you know, the youth of today would see the benefits of a life in uniform.
Cool. Jules, thank you very much for your time. I'm going to now go to Joshua in Edinburgh, who I think has a different perspective on this. Joshua, where do you stand on this?
Hi, James. Good to speak to you. I would be quite passionate to not fight for my country in a military capacity or otherwise. I think you made quite an interesting difference when you kind of mentioned it as service for the nation. And I would find it hard to justify service for a nation that I feel hasn't given me anything.
I think we're going to have a conversation here, Joshua. But go on. I will let you go on.
I am 22, so obviously the Conservatives, your party, were in power for a lot of my kind of development, and now that Labour have been in, albeit for a short period, it hasn't gotten much better.
Sure.
I'm just finished university. I've found it really, really hard to get a job after university. I now have a job that, you know, the pay is nothing compared to what it would have been 10, 15 years ago. I can't afford to get on the housing ladder. I think that the country is, by all stretches of the imagination, a lot worse than it was 10, 15 years ago. Public services are crippled. Just generally, you know, the streets are dirty. There's potholes on every road. And I just feel like it's not a country that I'm proud of. And I think there's an interesting discussion to have that people think national service and fighting for their country is fighting for the government of the day. And I do think there's an important contradiction to be made. But I think it's important to note that I think a lot of people see it that way, and that's why a lot of kind of my generation would be opposed to this service the country hasn't given us. an awful lot to be proud of, and it would be hard to fight for a country that, you know, I feel is quite often on the wrong side of history, especially in kind of military battles.
So, right, here we go. And I'm going to try not to have too much of a humdinger with you. But I think you're so off the mark. I really, really do. And I'm going to check my privileges here.
Okay.
I was Foreign Secretary, and it was my job to go around the world promoting the UK on the international stage. And I struggle to think of a country. If I could wave a magic wand, or rather, Joshua, if you could wave a magic wand and transpose yourself to somewhere else in the world, all else being equal, I think if you gave it some real thought, you would struggle to think of somewhere better to go, where there is more freedom, where there's more opportunity, where there is better protection for minorities, where there's a better health system, etc., etc. I think you would, if you thought it through, genuinely struggle. And a lot of the values that underpin those things are at risk in many parts of the world. And I think those things are well worth defending. And the fact that you don't interests me. And I don't want to be overly critical, but I think you've called it badly wrong.
I think that's fine. I take your point, and I actually agree with your point that if you compare us on an international basis, you know, we're up there. We're one of the best. But I think actually one of the best of a bad bunch isn't a great achievement. I think it's important that you mentioned that we have a lot of protection for minorities. I'm not necessarily sure that we are that great for minorities. I think if you look at most of I don't not want to fight for the UK and want to fight for someone else. I would have this opinion at any stage. We're constantly on the wrong side of history when it comes to these military battles. If you look at the two biggest battles, I think if you look at the two biggest issues internationally that are facing us just now, it's Russia, Ukraine, and it's Israel, Palestine. On the latter, we've refused to take any critical stance of Israel whatsoever. We're funding the genocide that is happening in that country. And when you look at Russia, Ukraine, we've got a government and a prime minister who refuses to stand up to Donald Trump, who's supposed to be our closest ally, when he closes up with Vladimir Putin on American soil. I think that we talk a lot of talk, and I think that that's probably the advantage of which you've seen when you were Foreign Secretary. I think we're very, very good at going out there and blowing our own trumpet. But I think when it comes to the actual practicalities of living in this country, especially for my generation, there's not an awful lot that's worth fighting for.
I'm sad to hear that, Joshua. Genuinely sad to hear it, but I do find it interesting. And genuinely, thank you for putting your position across. And thank you for doing it in a very thoughtful way. I'm going to go to another young person now, James in Norwich. James, what are your thoughts? What would you or would you not be willing to do for your country?
Hi, James. Nice to speak to you. I'm 18. I was in the cadet forces for 5 years in the air cadets. And I think I at the moment wouldn't want to fight for the country.
Okay.
But I think there's a wider issue there that the cadet forces aren't well enough advertised. I know lots of friends that have left cadets that have gone to join the RAF.
Mm.
So I think you need to advertise the cadet forces better as an option to see whether you'd want to go in first.
Well, I have a huge amount of time for the cadet forces. I think they do fantastic work, not necessarily as a pipeline to a military career, although a lot of cadets do that. But in of itself, it's an organisation which, you know, I've seen young people develop some lifelong friendships, huge amount of building of self-confidence, life skills. So I think the cadets, as with a number of other uniformed youth organisations, fantastic organisation. But again, you're echoing what Joshua was saying, that you don't feel proud enough of the country to want to defend what we've got. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, it is. I don't want to just go like reiterate Joshua's points, but I just don't feel like I just don't feel like this is a country that I personally want to fight for.
And so I'm going to throw this question out. I'm not going to demand that you answer it, because I'm going to go on to another caller before we get to the half-hour point. But I am willing to concede this country is far from perfect. But the question that I would like to put into people's minds is, should that be the threshold for defending what we have got? Because there are plenty of potential oppressors in this world that would want to take away some of the things that we would hold dear, and we do hold dear. And whilst no country is perfect, I'm not claiming the UK is perfect, I think we're in a very, very good place. I think there's plenty of things well worth defending. So before we get to the half hour point, I'm going to go to Andre in Cambridge. What are your thoughts on what you've heard so far this morning?
Hi, yeah, thank you. Well, the point I wanted to make is, the way I feel about this right now is that I'd fight to protect my family here at home if it came to it, God forbid. But the idea of being sent overseas to fight for an unknown agenda, I don't get that at all. And I just think you'd only had to watch the news recently to see how awful human beings can be towards each other. And I don't feel like none of us in the public really know what's going on at the top.
So how close to home would be close to home for you? I mean, would it be literally on our borders? Would it be in our near neighbourhood? And particularly when it comes to, you know, some things that we're seeing, some of the images that we're seeing this morning from Ukraine, an aggressor can do an awful lot of damage from a long way away. Where for you is the physical line, not necessarily the moral line, which you discussed, but the physical line? How close to home would it be for you to think, oh, I am now defending my family?
For me personally, it would literally have to be inside the UK. I can't reconcile with the idea of leaving my family here and going off to fight in a foreign land whilst our own country is full of the people that we may have fought in the past or may in the future. I'd want to be at home protecting my family.
So for you, it really is very much home defence rather than defending what we value a little bit further afield?
It really is, yeah. And I just think, you know, it's almost insanity that we keep taking the same approaches to foreign affairs, and as just a normal member of the public, it doesn't look like it's working. As I say, I might be completely unaware of loads of stuff, loads of great things that are working, but it doesn't look that way from what we see sort of day in, day out.
Well, look, Andre, you make an important point, and I've got to take some of this on the chin. I was the foreign secretary, and part of my job was not just promoting British values overseas, but making sure that British people understood why it was important that the UK had a powerful voice and muscle on the world stage. And if you're feeling that you don't instinctively get that, I've got to take some of that on the chin. Look, thank you for this. I'm finding this really interesting. I'm hoping you're finding it just as interesting as me. If you are, please get in contact. You're listening to me, James Cleverly. I'm standing in for James O'Brien on LBC. If you're finding this stimulating, if you've got something to say, if you want to tell me I'm an idiot and I'm wrong, or if you want to say that I'm completely right and you want to join the armed forces and defend the country, then call me and tell me so on 0345 6060 973. You can WhatsApp on the same number. But first, the news headlines from Thomas Watts.
A British council building and a European Union office have been damaged in Russian strikes on Ukraine's capital. At least 15 people, including children, are known to have been killed across Kyiv overnight. The Court of Appeal is hearing the latest part of the legal battle over an asylum hotel in Essex. The Home Office is trying to challenge an injunction stopping migrants being housed at the site in Epping. Two men charged in connection with the alleged rape of a 12-year-old girl in Nuneaton have pleaded not guilty to all charges. The 23-year-olds, who are reportedly Afghan asylum seekers, appeared at Warwick Crown Court this morning. LBC weather, sunshine and scattered showers for many, some heavy and thundery showers in places with the possibility of some hail, a high of 23 degrees.
LBC.
Would anyone like some Bourneville dark chocolate?
Is it so dark the aftertaste lasts for a week?
No.
Does it taste really,
really complicated.
What?
Is it saturated in nibs?
So dark it comes with a therapist.
To the uneducated palate, does it taste like burnt tyre?
Would scientists compare the taste to dark matter?
Is it artisanal, in all caps?
Other tasting notes, gloom.
No, no pretentiousness, no complexity, no bitterness. Just smooth dark chocolate from Cadbury. Cadbury Bourneville, made to be enjoyed, not endured.
The Virgin Atlantic holiday sale is now on. This is your sign to taste Jamaican jerk chicken so good it brings a tear to your eye. Catch a New York basement gig worth the 10-block detour. Or hit the dunes in Dubai and find sand in your pockets for weeks. Seize the sale. Book in store or online at Virgin Atlantic Holidays. Selected routes. For T's and C's, visit virginatlantic.com.
When we're little, we don't overthink things. We're brave, confident, we laugh and ask questions.
And play.
And play. So why stop there? Just because we're adults, it shouldn't mean we stop trying new things. For me, starting a career in early years has meant not just a new job, but new skills, new friends.
Like me.
Yes, and a new sense of purpose. All that, and I can earn while I learn.
Yay, painting next.
Do something big. Work with small children. Search early years careers to find out more.
Zero, nada, zilch. When Vauxhall say 0%, they mean 0%. 0% APR is available now across the Vauxhall car range, including the all-new Frontera Electric. With a minimum 20% deposit and up to 4 years on offer, what's not to like? And now, for a limited time, get an extra £500 towards your new Vauxhall. Search Vauxhall to find out more. Personal contract purchase, 20% deposit, £500 contribution on new car orders between 23rd of August to 8th of September 2025. 18 plus, subject to status and availability, T's and C's, Stellantis Financial Services.
This is LBC with James Cleverly. Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
You're listening to me, James Cleverly, and I'm standing in for James O'Brien here on LBC. And I'll be coming back to your calls about voluntary military service in just a moment. But first, we go to LBC's political editor, Natasha Clark, who joins me in the studio to give some detail on developments relating to a Russian attack in Kyiv that has been reported earlier on today.
Yeah, good morning. Good afternoon, James. As you've been hearing, of course, in the bulletins, and as you just mentioned, some very sad, tragic news coming out of Ukraine today. And it could really up the stakes, I think, and brings it a lot closer to home as well. So we understand Russian strikes on the Ukrainian capital have killed now at least 15 people, including four children, one just aged two. Officials are saying that 38 people have been injured, and they believe that this is now the largest attack on the Ukrainian capital since the end of July. And it's obviously the first time that Kyiv has been majorly hit since Donald Trump hosted Vladimir Putin in Alaska around a fortnight ago. The Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has today condemned this massive overnight attack. He's called for new tough sanctions on Moscow in response. But what's interesting about this, James, is that it's hit the British Council building and EU Council buildings too. Keir Starmer, the Prime Minister, has tweeted this morning, "My thoughts are with all those affected by the senseless Russian strikes on Kyiv, which have damaged the British Council building. Putin is killing children and civilians and sabotaging hopes of peace. This bloodshed must end." And the British Council has confirmed its office was severely damaged in the strikes. It's going to be closed to visitors until further notice. We've been seeing pictures of the scene showing windows blown out, there's glass everywhere, insulation and debris strewn on the ground. And in the last few minutes, I've just been told that Britain will be also summoning the Russian ambassador to the UK in response to this. So doing what they can to try and show that they are putting pressure on Russia to try to end the war and to try and stop these horrific strikes. But what it will do, James, I think, amongst the EU ministers is to strengthen their resolve. They obviously want to go a lot harder on Russia and Putin to force a peace deal. And obviously, after that Alaska summit, there has been a feeling in some EU circles and some diplomatic circles that obviously America and Trump, they're trying to get this deal over the line. They potentially haven't been quite as hardline on Putin as maybe they could have been. And this morning we've had quite a response from the EU's top diplomat, Kaya Kallas. She is saying that Russia is mocking peace efforts. They are summoning the Russian ambassador there in Brussels too. And last week, you'll remember, she had some very strong words for Putin, saying he doesn't want peace. Putin's been unable to keep his promises. She says that Putin is laughing at efforts to get to peace. And in the last last few minutes as well, James, we've also had the news Russia has confirmed a number of strikes overnight, but no mention of Kyiv at all. It says that the Russian forces stroke military targets in the Semidonetsk regions and Kherson and Kharkiv as well. Among the targets, they say, were ammunition depots and unmanned aerial vehicles. The Kyiv mayor has declared a day of mourning on Friday. And just one final point, where are we on that Russia-Ukraine possible meeting with Zelensky and Putin? It does feel a little bit further away today than it has maybe for potentially, you know, the last couple of weeks. We do know that on Friday, talks will take place between the US and Ukrainian officials. They will take place in New York. We know, of course, Putin has offered a meeting with Zelensky in Moscow. Zelensky's turned that down. And since that big summit of Zelensky and European leaders, we have not seen too much progress on that front. We obviously, as the UK, sent our Chief of Defence Staff out to Washington to try to hammer out a deal about what that security guarantee might look like. We haven't seen much come out of that just yet. America has, of course, been saying it won't send troops. But today feels, James, I think, like it's a huge step away from peace, not towards it.
Natasha, thank you. That was LBC's political editor, Natasha Clark. I'm going to be coming back to your calls about voluntary military service in a minute or two. But as you probably are aware, I am not James O'Brien. I'm James Cleverly. I'm standing in for James O'Brien. And tomorrow, a parliamentary colleague, Sir Ed Davey, the leader of the Liberal Democrats, will be standing in for James O'Brien. And I heard this morning in a shocking revelation that Sir Ed Davey has decided to boycott the state dinner with the President of the United States of America, Donald Trump. I'm sure that President Trump is currently sobbing, thinking of what could have been his opportunity to speak with the leader of the Liberal Democrats, an opportunity to denied now because of the leader of the Liberal Democrats, Edward Davey, boycotting the state banquet. If you detect a degree of cynicism or mocking in my voice, well done you, because I think this is the most foolish of performative gesture politics. Diplomacy is not about only talking to people that you agree with, it's about talking to people you disagree with. And I know that Sir Ed Davey has got deep disagreements with Donald Trump. I respect the fact he has disagreements with Donald Trump. But when you disagree with someone on the international stage, talk to them. Unless, of course, you don't think you have any influence. And if you don't think you have any influence, frankly, what on earth are you doing in politics? But I didn't get an invite, so maybe it's just sour grapes on my part. Let's go back to your calls now. Luke from Crawley. Luke, what are your thoughts on voluntary military service in the UK?
Good afternoon, James. Yeah, it's difficult to articulate. I think what sums it up probably best is that I'm an ex-serving Royal Marine. I only did a short time. I joined up when I was 19 years old and I left by the time I was 25. Shortly after that, September 11th happened, to give you some idea of my age. But I joined up because I was incredibly proud of my country growing up. I remember being a youngster, feeling sorry for people that weren't British. I thought, oh my goodness, how terrible. You know, I was brought up, I'm married to a foreign wife now. She laughs at me when I say it. But grew up incredibly proud. And my 17-year-old son asked me a month ago, Dad, is it still okay if I join the Royal Marines? And I just told him to hang in there, hang on for a while. I just don't know what he'd be fighting for anymore. And it's difficult to articulate truly what it is I mean by that. But the polarisation of our political system, you know, this pushing to the left and then for the alternative is a stronger right, neither of those are appealing propositions for me to fight for. And I, heaven forbid, my son sacrifice himself for either of those beliefs. I think we've got a wonderful history. And I think the continued rubbishing of our history and what we've generation after generation sacrificing for, believing they're doing the right things, of course there's been mistakes. And it all kind of feels like it's been rubbished. And I just don't know what we'd be fighting for now. I guess it depends who the hun is at the door. But
Luke, it's interesting you say that, because I'm uncomfortable with how much of British history is smashed to pieces in the minds of a lot of young people. And I think, therefore, it is understandable. I don't like it, I don't agree with it, but I think it's understandable that a lot of people, perhaps you included, don't think that the contemporary setup is worth fighting for. Now, I disagree with you on that, but I understand the point that you're making. And I worry that we've got a situation where the things that I think are well worth defending, as I say, not perfect, but well worth defending, that message isn't getting through. And I mean, you made an interesting point that it depends on where the threat comes from, where the risk is. And I, again, not trying to push you into a corner here, but I suspect that if some of the threats that we know are out there actually crystallise, that you'd probably be a little bit more willing to kind of to lean in and be more supportive. Could you envisage the circumstances where you would feel it is right, whether you're a member of your own family or someone in your circumstances from a younger era would take up arms to defend the nation?
I suppose it almost comes down to the fact if things have got so bad here, if it feels like we're being liberated or if we're being conquered. I can't imagine anyone overseas, in reality, offering anything better than we've currently got here.
I agree with you on that.
So I don't want to be too flippant when I say I don't know if I would really fight now. I mean, I'm in quite good shape, but I'm 50 years old at the end of the day. But I think what sums it up is my 17-year-old son, who in 2 or 3 years' time will be in a position and will be wanting to join the armed forces. And he wants it of either my blessing or he'll probably listen to me if I say no. Yeah. The current threats and what they're posed as of today, yeah, possibly. But if things carry on what's going on in this country in, 3, 4, 5 years' time, goodness knows. Honestly, goodness knows.
Thank you. Look, I'm going to quickly go to Thomas in Fife in Scotland. Thomas, what's your personal position on this?
Personally, James, I would not fight for the UK. Like some of the callers have said previously, if there was an invading force coming down that street, I would probably lift arms. That you speak repeatedly about values and that we should defend them and we should be proud of them. But if you look at the number of charities that collect for ex-servicemen and women, and you look at the adverts on TV for charities for ex-service personnel, it's apparent that the government don't value the troops, our sailors or our Air Force personnel. Otherwise, they would not have to rely on charity when they return injured, whether it's mental health issues or physical disabilities, on charities to see them through. We read in the papers about the housing that the MOD supply to our armed forces personnel being substandard. And this isn't just new, this is historical. This goes right back to the days of Earl Haig after World War I. Right? Then we go into the Normandy vets, the very people who pushed back the tyranny of fascism. When they got home, they did not come home to a Britain that was better. They still had to rely on charity. And then after that, we had our service personnel who were used as lab rats in nuclear testing and who are fighting for compensation from the government. How can you expect people to take up arms to defend a system that doesn't value them?
Thomas, look, I hear what you say, but before we break again, I just want to quickly go to Ryan in Bromley to put what I think might be a counter view. Ryan, what are your thoughts?
Oh, hello. So I totally agree with your point on wanting to fight for the country. I'm 23 years old. Got my assessment for the reserve centre next week, actually. And I think it's more of a less than a political standpoint to go fight for the government, per se. I think it's more of like an honourable thing to actually want to stand up and fight for your home, because if someone isn't going to fight, then who else is going to fight? I think it's important to want to be able to do that, because, you know, this is our home, and this is, and I agree with what you said previously about how, you know, there's so much more that we actually got here. Like, yes, I understand people are upset that the so-called government are taking from us and not giving back to us, but if you're on a grand scheme of things, we actually have quite a good gig here, and I think that's something to stand up and fight for.
Ryan, thank you. I'm sorry I'm going to cut you off a little bit, but I've overrun on what should be the break. But you're listening to me, James Cleverly, here on LBC. I'm going to take a few more calls before I finish at 1 o'clock. But for now, the time is 12:47.
Coming up at 1 on LBC, Asma Mia.
There are too many diagnoses of children with special educational needs, according to a report. Do some kids and parents need to toughen up?
Asma Mia on LBC.
Zero, nada, zilch. When Vauxhall say 0%, they mean 0%. 0% APR is available now across the Vauxhall car range, including the all-new Frontera Electric. With a minimum 20% deposit and up to 4 years on offer, what's not to like? And now, for a limited time, get an extra £500 towards your new Vauxhall. Search Vauxhall to find out more. Personal contract purchase, 20% deposit, £500 contribution on new car orders between 23rd of August to 8th of September 2025. 18 plus, subject to status and availability, T's and C's, Stellantis Financial Services.
The Virgin Atlantic Holiday Sale is now on. This is your sign to taste Jamaican jerk chicken so good it brings a tear to your eye. Catch a New York basement gig worth the 10-block detour. Or hit the dunes in Dubai and find sand in your pockets for weeks. Seize the sale. Book in-store or online at Virgin Atlantic Holidays. Selected routes. For T's and C's, visit virginatlantic.com.
Pump six in this meal deal, please.
Let's play Rate My BP Meal Deal.
Okay.
You chose an M&S chicken and bacon pasta, Magnum ice cream and a Wild Bean Cafe iced latte. That's a 10. A perfect warm weather combo.
Have I won a holiday?
No. BP Meal Deal. One deal, millions of combinations. All for £6.
T's and C's apply, subject to availability at BP M&S stores only. For details, see bp.com/latest offers.
Would anyone like some Bourneville dark chocolate?
Is it so dark the aftertaste lasts for a week?
No.
Does it taste really, really complicated?
What?
Is it saturated in nibs?
So dark it comes with a therapist?
To the uneducated palate, does it taste like burnt tyre?
Would scientists compare the taste to dark matter?
Is it artisanal, in all caps?
Are the tasting notes gloom?
No, no pretentiousness, no complexity, no bitterness. Just smooth dark chocolate from Cadbury. Cadbury Bourneville. Made to be enjoyed, not endured.
Hey, Mum. So, you know we met Zara, my financial advisor?
Yeah.
Yeah, from St. James's Place. Well, she drafted our plan so you can get that bungalow near me.
Oh,
and Sam, that lovely carer we found, will drop in. And I can bring over my signature shepherd's pie. Hoi!
Big decisions call for invaluable advice. Visit St. James's Place to find your one-to-one financial advisor. St. James's Place Wealth Management PLC is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. SJP approved 19th of Feb 25.
James Cleverly on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
You're listening to me, James Cleverly, on LBC, standing in for James O'Brien. Let's go straight to Michael in Manchester on the idea of volunteering for military service. Michael, where's your head at on this issue?
It was specifically a response to the question you spoke to. You asked one of the earlier callers. I think it was the 18-year-old cadet, and you wanted him and the rest of the nation to kind of consider whether we should be fighting for the things that we hold near and dear. And my point and thought to that question was that a bit closer to home, we have people who are trying to take us out of the ECHR and take away things that we consider to be dear within our own country. And until things like that stop within the country, then trying to put yourself forward within 4 years, we could be looking at a government run by those same people. I can't imagine a lot of people would be willing to fight for that if their human rights have been taken.
So which rights specifically do you think are at risk of being taken away?
The ECHR, 16 human rights or...
No, yeah, but which ones do you think, genuinely, which ones do you think are at risk of going?
So the right to a fair trial, our right to family life.
Because those things existed before the creation of the ECHR in British common law, indeed, before the ECHR was incorporated into British law. Now, look, and it's one of the things that I think is kicking around. I don't want to be pulled too far off of topic, yeah. but you know, the UK, Britain, had habeas corpus way, way, way before the ECHR, right to, you know... The whole load of rights that massively predate this structure, but because this is, again, it's one of these things where, you know, not wanting to accuse you specifically of this, I do sometimes think that there are some straw man arguments put up to basically say, you know, I don't particularly like necessarily the people involved in government or politics at the moment, and therefore I'm gonna say that, you know, this isn't a system that I want to fight for, whereas, as I say, I look around at all the alternatives. I look around at pretty much all the others all the other regimes that under which we might live, and I struggle to think of somewhere better than here.
Those regimes have less human rights than we currently have, so obviously somebody trying to take them away makes you think we could be headed down that road. I understand that there was probably human rights kind of laws before the ECHR came into play, but obviously, unless a plan, again, with the reform act, it's never an actual plan. We haven't got a plan to say, we're going to take these away, but we will replace them with this. You know, it's just, this is our plan. We have no idea what we're heading towards. So why would anybody go down that route, change your entire life potentially if you had a plan up until now? You all of a sudden change direction completely, head down this route, and then that's what you find you've been working towards.
I can't say I'm convinced, but I do appreciate your calling in. I'm going to go back to Bromley and talk to Holly in Bromley. What are your thoughts on what you've heard so far today?
Hello, James. So I think I very much agree with what you just said then. I think that the problem is, and speaking, so I'm 22 years old, so kind of speaking on behalf of other young people, I think that the general problem we have at the moment is that perhaps we are so privileged that our measure for bad country has been incredibly distorted. Like you were saying, comparing to the other countries in which we could be living and the other laws in which we could be living under. I mean, there are 64 jurisdictions across the world where same-sex activity is illegal. Like approximately 100 million women live in countries where they cannot own land. And I think we take the smallest things because we are so privileged and we use them as a reason to not feel that the country's worth defending. And this isn't to say that I would, you know, without question, fight for any cause in the country. But I do think that the argument of bad country or immoral country, I think that it, all of us being, you know, distorted and being very kind of unself-aware of what we actually have.
It's an interesting point you make there, Holly, because the German government's actions are explicitly driven because they have seen what Russia is doing on the eastern side of Europe. And when I speak to friends and colleagues in Scandinavia, in the Balkan states, down towards the Black Sea, the countries that are physically closer than we are to the oppressive regime in Moscow recognize what is at stake, I think, better than we do. And that is not a criticism of some of the callers that we've had, but I agree with you. I think that we take a look at what is the imperfect model that we have, and I concede we are not perfect, and we transpose that thinking to believe that because we are not perfect, what we've got is not worth defending. And I fundamentally disagree with that. And I'm optimistic that we've had a couple of young callers so far today who have said that they value what we've got. I think we've got time for perhaps one more call. And I'm going to go to Adam in Liverpool. Adam, tell me I'm right or tell me I'm wrong.
Regarding to joining the forces, I feel that a lot of the younger generation wouldn't, myself included.
Okay.
Reason being for that would be, I feel people don't feel the fulfillment of this country. I think they don't feel fulfilled. I mean, while we have all these wonderful services, NHS, and obviously a lot of the other countries, when you're in detail, don't have them. While it's classed as a free health service, it's not free. I think ultimately everyone's on the breadline, more so than ever. I feel if people had a bit more relief as such into it, I think we'd go for the fight for the country a lot more. We'd want to. When you also speak to, when you compare to the older generation, when you speak to your nans, your granddads, when you speak to them when they were younger, they would also know their neighbours two roads down, three roads down. They were a lot more community. I don't remember nowadays wherever I come out to, you don't just pop out and speak to your neighbours as a hi and a bye. We're not there together we're not there as a unit, as a country. We look out for one another. We look out just for your closest, your relatives and family. You don't typically go beyond that. I feel ultimately it's just
Adam, I think you've made, and I'm going to finish on this point, because I think you've made a really, really interesting and important point that we are not going to have enough time to explore today, because you, I think, have made the point that a whole load of people who might not necessarily go and join the military for king and country, but would feel driven to defend their community, their society, their nearest and dearest, the people that they know and love, which is perhaps something a bit more meaningful and tangible than this rather abstract idea of defending the nation. I think that's a very, very important point. And Adam, I'm going to end on that point. So thank you to everyone that has called in today or sent messages in, even if I wasn't able to get you online or read them out. You've been listening to me, James Cleverly, on LBC. Tomorrow, Sir Ed Davey is going to be standing in for James O'Brien. Coming up at 4 o'clock on LBC, Ben Kentish is standing in for Tom Swarbrick. But next, standing in for Sheila Fogarty is Asma Mir.
Thank you very much, James. 1 in 5 children in England have special educational needs and disabilities. A new report says that is too many. The system is being overwhelmed. It says children with severe problems should get help faster. In fact, the whole system needs to change. There need to be fewer education and healthcare plans. Are some diagnoses perhaps misplaced that could be treated in a different way, as Jeremy Hunt is arguing? Or should we take very seriously the needs of children who are struggling?
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 1 o'clock, the Russian ambassador has been summoned to the Foreign Office over last night's strike on Kyiv. At least 15 people, including 4 children, were killed in the missile and drone attack. An EU delegation office and the British Council building were both damaged. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen says the EU will come forward with new sanctions on Russia.
And this is another grim reminder of what is at stake. It shows that the Kremlin will stop at nothing to terrorize Ukraine, blindly killing civilians, men, women and children, and even targeting the European Union. This is why we are keeping maximum pressure on Russia.
Russia has not yet claimed responsibility for the strikes. The first stage of the government's appeal against a ban on housing asylum seekers at a hotel in Essex is being heard at the Court of Appeal. The Home Office and Somani Hotels Limited are seeking permission to challenge an interim injunction at the Bell in Epping. Two men have denied charges relating to the alleged abduction and rape of a 12-year-old girl in Nuneaton. The 23-year-olds, who are reportedly Afghan asylum seekers, appeared at Warwick Crown Court this morning. The case has sparked debate over whether the immigration status of people charged with offences should be revealed by police. Landlords could face extra taxes in the autumn budget. The Treasury is reportedly considering bringing in national insurance on rental income with the aim of raising £2 billion. Business commentator Victoria Scholar says this is among many options the Chancellor will be considering.
There's a £40 billion fiscal black hole that she's trying to plug. Essentially, the government just doesn't have enough money. So it's clearly going to be looking at lots of different ways to try and increase taxes while causing minimal pain. And I think there's going to be lots and lots of rumours and speculation between now and the autumn budget.
The Treasury hasn't denied the reports, but says it's committed to keeping taxes for working people as low as possible. And a 59-year-old man from Lancashire has been arrested in connection with racist messages sent to England's Jess Carter during the Euros. The Lioness was targeted during the tournament back in July. In the city a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading down 32 points at 92.22. The pound buys $1.35 and €1.15. LBC weather, mostly cloudy skies this afternoon with heavy showers moving in from the west. A few sunny spells between the showers later, a high of 23 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Amelia Cox.
Some companies try to reel people in by promising quick cash if you pay them to claim work expenses. But think twice before taking the bait, because they might just want to land a commission, and it turns out you aren't eligible to claim anything. You'll have to pay HMRC back, and it's unlikely the company will refund any fees. So don't get caught out. Check if you're eligible and make a claim with HMRC for free online. Just search Don't Get Caught Out.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Asma Mir.
Good afternoon. This is Asma Mir sitting in for Sheila Fogarty for the rest of the week here on LBC. It is 4 minutes past one. We are going to talk about something that is often discussed, and I know that it does exercise people a lot, specifically if this applies to you. Young people apparently are being over-diagnosed with mental ill health, mental health problems. This comes from a report called Out of Control by the Policy Exchange, and it's got a foreword by former Health Secretary Jeremy Hunt, or Sir Jeremy Hunt now, who says a couple of things. He says that mental ill health and neurodiversity now accounts for more than half of the post-pandemic increase we've seen in claimants of disability benefit. He says that perhaps throwing more money, more of the same when it comes to diagnosing young people, that might not be the right thing to do. What about the importance of good work, physical activity, social connection? These factors are too often deprioritised in our policy prescription. But the report does say that children who have the most severe problems should get help much faster. A lot of children are kind of lost in the system. They're languishing there for, you know, weeks, months, some of them even years. And so the report is saying two things, I think, really, that there does seem to be some overdiagnosis in their opinion, but that some young children are being They are being overlooked. They're lost in the system, and they really do need to get this help very, very quickly. Now, I know this is something that does exercise you, especially if you have a child who has just been diagnosed with autism, ADHD, whatever it might be, who has one of these education, health and care plans. So I would love to hear from you. Of course, you're the people, you're the experts, you're the people who've gone through the system. You know exactly what is happening. 03456060973. Are we, as this report suggests, over-diagnosing mental health conditions in children? We're going to speak to Hayley Harding now, who is founder of Let Us Learn Too. It's an alliance of disabled people, charities, parent groups, and others that support the rights of disabled children and young people. Good afternoon to you, Hayley.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
When you hear the word over-diagnosis, What's your initial reaction?
Unfortunately, it's something we keep hearing, and it's just not, doesn't have a basis of fact. There was a report that came out from King's College University recently that said, actually, we're underdiagnosing, not over. And the reason for the increase is because we're more aware, which is a good thing. We should be celebrating this. We can teach our children better. We can give them the right support in a way that is better for their needs. And yet, for some reason, we have reports like this that want to attack that. And it just doesn't really make any sense.
I think for some people, I suppose, for think tanks, for politicians, they look at it not only through a health point of view, but through an economic point of view. And I think the kind of the undertone here is that this is just too expensive. Can you understand that, or do you think that actually the cost doesn't matter? If children have special educational needs, they need to. That's what we do in 2025. We might not have done it 20 years ago, 30 years ago, but we have to. We have to basically take the hit financially.
To a degree, yes. But we do have to still support these children. We can't just pretend those needs aren't there, not diagnose them, and then not give them the support, which will end up costing us a lot more in the long run. Look, there are ways that we can make this system more economical. Our parents were trying to call for involvement to try and help with that. We recognise that money is tight, but that doesn't mean to say that reports like this should be given. I think it's very hard as somebody who's a parent and as somebody who represents a lot of parents to see reports like that when we've all just gone through a very tough summer, to be honest, we don't get a lot of support. And then to come out and see articles like this, a very senior MP saying, like Jeremy Hunt, making comments like this, it's quite heartbreaking, because all we want to do is get a bit of help, get a leg up, see our children go to school and be happy. And yet instead we're having to deal with having to try and justify why our children have the needs that they do.
The report says, Hayley, that blanket approach doesn't always work. And I think what they mean by that is that if you go through the system and you apply for an education, health and care plan, I mean, obviously not everyone is going to get that, but that some children perhaps don't need that. But because the system is kind of, I mean, again, I have no experience of the system, because the system is the way that it is, that there are only a couple of outcomes. And I think what they're saying is that it's not always the answer to just slap an EHCP on someone and then, you know, that's the kind of the magic wand. Is there anything in that? Does that process always work?